morning to those of you who came in a bit late. I've already greeted everybody who is on time. I'd like to welcome all of you to this meeting of the Portfolio Committee of Public Enterprises. Do we have any apologies? The light is not on. Red light.
Good morning. The apologies I've received is from Mr. Hololo, who is debating in the matter of CPC, Mr. Sondo. Michael is running a bit delete, and Dr. Corn of the Orbit is a short bit. Mr. Nye is also attending an EPC, the only good one.
We never give departments or entities an opportunity to give their apologies. Any apologies from your side?
Thank you. This is the chairman of Asian.
The chairman. Okay, noted. Any other apology, Lan? Because on our side we have new members who join the committee, and I don't think we've ever met with your team, Mr. Damas. So we'll start from the start. My name is Peter Maluleka. I'm a member of this committee.
Gloria Borman, member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Dumisani Kimbi from the committee.
Good morning. My name is Anapila Machake, member of the committee.
Good morning. Eric Marine, member of the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Clarkland Moita, to various members of the energy industry.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mako Huma from the Department of Public Enterprise.
My name is everyone. Lisa Commander from TV.
Sanit Fuster, Transmit, early arriver, and inviting me as my colleague.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Nombi Matomela from ESCOM Parliamentary Affairs.
Morning, Chair, honorable members. Hilary Duffy from ESCOM.
Good morning, Chair. Short side to ESCOM.
Good morning, Chair. Paul O'Flaherty, Funds Director, ESCOM.
Brian Dawes, Chief Executive of ESCOM.
Hey, honourable members, Karen De Villiers from ESCOM.
Morning, Chair and members. My name is Rodney Mnisi, contact advisor to the committee.
Morning, everyone. My name is Anna Sattel. I'm a contact assistant.
Morning, I'm Lee Vimmel. I'm the researcher for the committee.
The late arrival.
Gerard Kuernok, member of the committee.
We have other people right at the back there.
Morning, Renan Albertus, SAS.
Morning, and Fisher SAS.
SAS.
This is Aaron CNG.
Mr. Damas and his team, Honorable Klimbi and Honorable Lani Majaki.
have replaced Honorable Santo and Honorable Shatela, who you know. So there was a reshuffling, and so the two members have been deployed to other committees, and Honorable Timbi and Pilani Machaki are now with us here. We have only one item for this part of the meeting, and that's a briefing by ESCOM on the progress of the infrastructure build program and the economic impact thereof. Mr. Danis, over to you.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you to the committee and members of the committee. I'm pleased to announce that within ESCOM we've not had any reshuffling, so we all and
that gives our mission a lot of assurance that at least the lights will be on for some time.
Thank you, Jay. Paul and I thought this was important that we attend the session as always and engage with you. Honourable Chairman and members, we are here to share with you the progress ESCOM is making around its infrastructure program, and also to share many successes that we've had. And yes, there are some real challenges because we are the ones that has been far advanced in terms of our execution of our infrastructure program. We're also here to share with you the progress that we've made since we started this, and its two aspects of it, how we've dealt with absolutely mega projects, and how have we made sure that we really at the same time build internal capability, not just for ourselves, but also for the broader ESCOM as well as the public sector. However, before I start and before I get into the presentation, I'd like to just provide a context in terms of our program and the objectives our country has around economic development. Because I think it's very important when we talk about these things that we reflect the context in which we do these things. And for that purpose, I'd like to reflect on two budget speeches that were made. First, that of Minister of Finance, and secondly, that of Minister of Public Enterprises. In his budget speech, the Minister of Finance indicated that one of the transformation imperatives over the next 20 to 30 years is that the economic competitiveness is crucially important for the country. And for us to achieve that, as a country, we have to invest in infrastructure. We need to build on the base that we have, and we need to particularly build on the base that we have within the energy and electricity sector. He's also raised the need for improved planning and the need for the management of strategic infrastructure projects. And I think this morning I'd like to spend a bit of time on that and share with the committee the work that we've done in that regard. He's indicated that over the next 3 years, 827 billion rand is planned to be spent by fiscals and federal companies. And financing of these are all in place and are not affected by any of the spending cuts within the 2013 budget. It's further indicated that it's been allocated 430 billion and has been allocated for schools, for hospitals, for clinics, for dams, for water, electricity infrastructure, as well as the electrification of over 1 million new homes throughout our country. And most of the spending falls under, obviously, provinces and municipalities. And within the state and companies, both ESCOM and Transnet will be funding a further 400 billion rand for our own projects. And this is financed very importantly through our own resources and additional borrowings that we then do over the next 3 years, supported obviously by government and treasury guarantees. I think that provides us the first context, that this infrastructure development we're busy with are crucially important for the country. It is funded. A lot of it is being rolled out both to address infrastructure needs and to address the basic needs of our people. If I reflect on the Minister of Public Enterprises budget vote, he has clearly indicated the impact of these programs, that it's already having a massive impact on the transformation of the economy in terms of developing of black-owned companies, the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, and more important for South Africa, the development of skills. And indicated that this must continue, that as we build this infrastructure, we must, as a country, build the skills that allows us to catalyze the effect of making sure we as a country build the necessary skills, industries to sustain us going forward. He mentioned that we plan to spend as ESCO 337 billion rand over the next 5 years. Obviously, we would have to review this in light of the MIPD3 decision, and I'm working with government in this regard. And so when I talk about our expenditure today, we will certainly, it's obviously still reflecting the work that we still need to do with government, and that government as a shareholder is committed to ensure that Eskom remains financially sustainable to allow us to deliver on our commitments. He's indicated that Eskom's funding plan for the build program is finalized, and 82% has been secured, signed, and finalized, and we can certainly make sure that we deal with that. But lastly, he's given an indication that Eskom has codified the lessons that we've learned by implementing these projects in a comprehensive toolkit and has established a project management center of excellence by training based on this project management toolkit. And we are exploring ways to make this resource available to other state companies and the broader environment within government to make sure that as a country we can enhance our ability to manage very complex mega projects. And I think that provides a great sense of context and a background that I would like to then move into the presentation, Chairman. If we look at Eskom, the topic I would like to cover this morning is to start off with that toolkit and that project management capability that we put up. I'll give a sense of the Eskom capital expansion program. And Paul, our finance director, when Paul and I got together 3 years ago, we agreed that we're going to run the organization in a very specific manner. And I've asked him to look after the capital expansion program over and above the fact that he was finance director. And I had a very good reason why. Two reasons. One is that he had a contract, he came from the construction industry, so he knew all these guys that we all see in the media about what the bad things they did, so he would be able to deal with it. The second thing is because of the capital. Within a company like Eskom, given our capital that's spent, it was crucially important to make sure finance is very close to the capital and the control of capital and the funding thereof. And that was the reasons why. So Chairman Paul will deal with a bit more detail around Madupi, Kusile, Angula, and transmission. And throughout the presentation, I will obviously add to that. So if we go to the first slide, to really talk about Eskom's project engineering, procurement and construction and project management capability. And we have set up in Eskom what we call an EPCM organization. And this organization is undertaking and managing amongst the largest construction projects in the world. Madupi and Kusile ranks amongst the top 5 power stations in size globally. Our portfolio is diverse. It includes projects of energy. It includes projects of transportation. It includes projects of water and communication. It is geographically spread throughout the country and position throughout the whole of South Africa. And obviously, as we move forward, actively we'll be engaging in Southern Africa as Eskom's role expansion in the continent. And through the delivery of these large construction projects, Eskom has continued to invest in improving our engineering, our procurement, and our construction and project management capability. But over and above that, our people, our systems, and our processes and tools that we actually use in this regard. We have aligned our contract management and financial systems, our project controls, our project systems, and then more importantly, our quality standards and safety with that of our peers globally, together with the lessons that we have learned, and then embedded that into one organization in Eskom, that is our EPCM organization. Increasing supply from the local industry and creating jobs, we all know it's critical. How do we localize and how do we make sure we use this infrastructure development to create jobs is absolutely critical. And this requires knowledge, it requires skill, and it requires technology transfer. And we continue to actively drive this by incentivizing particularly our industry partners and employing local labor, and then also making sure we build capacity through training and development. But Chairman, it's very important to reflect that since we started in 2005, and we must realize that Eskom has last built the power station in the 1980s when it started doing this. And then we have to start up again in 2005. And since we started in 2005, and now we've delivered over 6,000 megawatts of new capacity to the South African power system, over 4,600 kilometers of transmission network. This is a high voltage transmission line throughout the country. And 23,700 MVAs of substation or transformer capacity throughout the whole of South Africa. So the infrastructure that we currently have under construction creates direct jobs on sites, approximately 40,000 people, and more than 50% of everything that we have contracted, actually it's getting in cases close to 60%, has all gone to South African companies to make sure that we drive local industry development. In growing this organization, we must reflect where we come from. The world has certainly changed since we last built power stations in the 1970s and 1960s in the country. The supply industry, by the early 2000s, when we had to do all this, we found that the supply industry has been consolidating, and we've had a lot less competition, and capacity was significantly reduced. We had Asian suppliers that entered the market. We have, at the time, provided them an opportunity into our market. They did not meet our requirements. And we have seen established suppliers, many international established suppliers that has been outsourcing many of their activities to Asian suppliers, and this certainly had an impact on our case, particularly as far as the quality of many of the goods and services are concerned. We had an economic boom that created pressure on construction costs, while we had a financial crisis, obviously, that has put significant financial constraints on infrastructure development. And as a country, we decided that we would do this by an increased focus on local industry creation, local industry development, and make sure that we use these projects to build many of these things. And if we look at our projects, these are some of the largest, as I said, in the world. The challenges that they pose is massive interfaces that we have to manage as Eskom amongst, as an EPCM contractor, amongst multiple contracts. We had to drive the local content and make sure we also deal with quite a vast amount of unskilled workforce that needed to be trained. We had different execution partners in terms of the design that we had to do. And when we started in 2005, we had no designs for these stations because the last station Eskom was built was in Majuba Power Station. So what we had to do was use Majuba as our footprint for what we contracted and then get the boiler and turbine contract to actually do the design and then come back and then adjust the civils. And that's what we referred to as virtual designs. That was an estimate of what we had. And that is an impact came in our really the country's ability to plan and not start infrastructure development going forward. Because those are some of the impact one then faces. Very important, we're currently building Medupi and Kusile a lot faster than what we've ever as a country done before because we've not invested for a long time. I think Medupi and Kusile schedules are 3 times faster than what any of us previous power stations was built at. But in us establishing our organization, we put an organization together that captures our procurement capabilities, Eskom, our engineering capability, our construction management capability, which is distinctly different to project management, different to project development. We obviously have to look at sustainability and continuous innovation, safety, which is a big part of our business, and then the governance of our projects. And that is what comprises Eskom EPCM organization. But we have gone through a journey that we've learned many lessons on. When we started this race in 2005, we've had lessons around how do we make sure we rationalize the resources that we have, how do we make sure we negotiate the contracts that we have in place. We needed to start on-site construction and at the same time drive cost savings within our efforts. We then had to make sure we implement uniform systems and processes across our projects. We spent in parallel of building these things a lot of time in building this organization and now really making sure that we're becoming a more professional and more action-oriented owner of these infrastructure and make sure that we drive continuous improvement in that regard. We are utilizing various processes and systems in our project management support. I'm not going to go through all of the slides, but we're utilizing an integrated approach. We have one operating project management operating model. We have standardized business processes. It's contained to 22 process control manuals that is documented. We have one standard organizational structure. We have one standard system platform, and we have one uniform assurance review to help us deal with this. And many of this is supported by very specific project management processes and systems that we've now standardized for at entity level, at ESCOM level, on a project portfolio level, and then for each of the different projects. And then we make sure that that interfaces with what the industry uses in terms of the third party spies. But we have set up an engineering and project management office to ensure that we standardize all of this, because for us that was very important, that we standardize our project management processes in ESCOM. On the next slide, the specific objectives are pursued is to make sure that we appropriately scale resources that's available on time at the right price for all of our projects, that we provide standardized processes and governance and tools for the management of resources, the support delivery of governance, job creation and skills objectives, ensure that we have appropriate skills development across our own capability and what's happening inside of the projects, monitor the materials and equipment plans against the agreed requirements, and then very importantly for us, for South Africa in particular, maximize the productivity of resources across the portfolios that we have. Chairman, we have created centers of excellence around project management, around the management of contracts, around the management of risk, the project controls, how we deal with integrated resource planning, and then also process and systems integration, and the implementation through a project management office, and then we have quite extensive monitoring and oversight functions that we have implemented. Together with that, implemented quite an extensive training and development process that is supported through academic and professional training requirements. We have developed specific curricula for each position within our structures, we've got 29, and many of them are standards, and then standard, and each of these consists of many specific courses that is designed to make sure through our Academy of Learning, we then go through an assessment process for each of those positions. And that is now with a specific focus in making sure we commit to contractor training over and above the training of our own people, with the main focus of our training being on our project control manuals for our project management systems, our new engineering contracts, and then the free contracts, which are standard conditions of contract, as well as project contract management and the management, obviously, of all the project systems that we have within ESCOM. This we've captured in ESCOM in what we call the Project Management Guidebook. We have a guidebook in place that is there for us to build confidence in our understanding and capability in managing capital projects, in sharing our lessons and learnings, and what key success factors will take to manage such a diverse portfolio of projects, to share our philosophy around project development and delivery processes, as well as a reference guide and as a learning tool for all of our practitioners. And the lessons is covered in some broad areas, how we deal with project capital allocation, how we deal with managing projects through a project lifecycle management process, as well as enablers that we have, safety, the environmental requirements, quality, project controls, organizational structure, and the capabilities and needs to them. All of this captured within specific lessons in the specific project management guidebook. Chairman, on the next slide, we have gone through quite an extensive process of global benchmarking. We've benchmarked our approach to project management by our peers globally around the use of our contracts, standard contracts, across not only utilities, but within companies that in the energy sector, around the use of the systems, the use of a project lifecycle management process, Primavera, which we use for project management, our ISO quality requirements, as well as how we deal with our safety aspects. And we're very comfortable that ESCOM's processes are aligned with that of our peers globally. We have an industry structure process that is used that all projects go through a project definition readiness assessment, and unless the project gets to a point where it's actually got a specific score that is low enough, we do not proceed with the project into execution. Making sure that all of the projects that we go through a proper pre-planning process, a proper concept development process, a proper definition process before we start into releasing projects for execution. We have taken quite a number of steps to look at our own performance and improving all of that. Last year we ran quite an extensive lessons learned process from around the world. We invited many people from around the world to come and talk to us about managing large projects. And out of that, certainly a lot of lessons were learned from that perspective. And we're not alone in what we're doing. In what we're experiencing in major projects, we're certainly not alone. Most of the European power plants we have visited have seen delays of the projects up to 2 years, if not longer. The nuclear facilities are being built in, I think, Finland is still ongoing and still experiencing significant delays. The primary reason for this is sometimes individualized designs and new designs, but other problems including specific issues and very specific to what we have, welding issues with specific material, low quality, low steel manufacturing quality, around contractors and specific logistics on and off the site to make sure that these projects are executed. So we have run this workshop. We actually developed quite a comprehensive package of lessons learned from our colleagues from around the world. But our capital project on the next slide, our capital program in Eskom, Chairman, is on par with international utilities. If you look at our capital allocation, and again I make the point that this is in terms of our MYP3 application, obviously this will be readjusted given the regulator's decision. Most of our allocation of capital goes to our group capital and our EPCM organization that runs all our capital. The second largest will go to our generation division, and then for the refurbishment of our existing power station, and then distribution for the expansion of networks. And within the South African environment, our investment as Eskom is unparalleled in South Africa. Nobody, but nobody in South Africa spends more capital than Eskom on an annual basis. Our spend is 60 billion rand on average a year, and that is about the amount that we will maintain over the next few years. And as you can see with E.ON, which is a utility out of Germany, and now out of Italy, and RWE out of Germany, our capital spend per annum is in par with our international peers. So, Chairman, the first part of this is that we have at the same time as executing many of these things, have been building a very structured approach to project management. Make sure that we document and codify these lessons. We've set up a project management school at Eskom that actually goes through many of these things that we have identified and trained specifically people, and it's available and already being utilized not only for Eskom, but for entities outside of Eskom as well. And what we see includes lessons from our own history over the last few years, as well as that we've gained from our colleagues internationally. If we then in the second chapter look more specifically at Eskom's expansion program, and we were given three assignments in 2005 when Cabinet decided that Eskom should start expanding after years of saying Eskom should not expand. And this is what we have done for every year. Up to now, as I said, over 6,000 megawatts has been delivered. In the last financial year, 261 megawatts. New capacity has been delivered within the South African power system. The transmission networks throughout the country being built, and these are large 476 ultra-high voltage transmission lines throughout South Africa, over 4,600 kilometers of this being built, that is connected all of South Africa, from Limpopo into Gauteng, from Gauteng into KZN, from KZN into Eastern Cape, from Free State into Eastern Cape, and from Gauteng all the way through the Free State, through the Northern Cape into the Western Cape. At the same time, we've built these substations throughout the whole of the country. So if you go into Cape Town, you will see that there's brand new Eskom substations in Stikland, there's close to Kuwait new substations, and if you drive from here all the way into Johannesburg, you will see the new substations and new transmission lines that has been built. And a significant capacity has been built up over the last few years. So Eskom has delivered, since 2005, a significant amount of infrastructure that the country needs. The next slide gives a very detailed picture of our capital portfolio. It is diversified and it is complex. In 2005, we were given an assignment to return to service three old power stations that was decommissioned in the early 80s. I must say to you, Chairman, this is the largest refurbishment project probably undertaken by any utility to bring back 3,800 megawatts. Now, we have done all of it except 100 megawatts. Camden is fully commissioned. Fruitflow is fully commissioned and operational today, and Kumati has got one unit left, and that is the one that we have to finish this year. In terms of the development in a baseload capacity, we are doing project development work around nuclear, particularly the development of nuclear sites and front-end planning in that regard.
We're doing development around biomass co-firing, particularly the work that we're doing in conjunction with SAFCO around how we can use biomass. And then obviously we're doing a significant amount of road-to-rail lines to our current power stations. Under construction we have Gudupi and Kusile as iceberg stations. With our peaking portfolio, we have just put Sierra into construction, so that must have moved towards the bottom. We have in development our first concentrated solar plant, and we have under development significant solar photovoltaic plant that we will use and install in our own facilities. But we have delivered within the Western Cape Ankerlug, which has got a capacity of over 1,300 megawatts. Within Maslow Bay, Gorikwa, that's close to 700 megawatts. We're busy constructing in Gula. We have completed at Letabo, Merriwack Park, and Kendall solar PV power generation of just over 1.6 megawatts, and we will continue to roll that out to all of our power stations. But at the same time, Chairman, we're busy refurbishing our existing power stations, particularly the air quality projects that we have in terms of fabricated plant bags. We have under construction the increase of Arnold by 300 megawatts. That's completed. We're busy with the refurbishment of Matla, the refurbishment of our Kulu power station, and has just started the refurbishment of our Kulu power station to make sure that they can last for another 20 years. We have spoken about the transmission networks that have been developed throughout the whole of the country. There's still more transmission projects under development, this certainly would yield that when we finish this Eskom by about 2019 with this project, we would have added about 50% to our capacity. In terms of our power stations, working towards the first utilization of our Marupi unit, that will continue up to 2016, Kusile in 2014, continue up to 2018, and then Ngula to then be completed in 2014, but Paul will take us through that in a lot more detail. It's important to note that Medupi and Kusile would be the first supercritical power stations in South Africa that is a lot more efficient than what we currently have installed. This has been done, and none of this has gone without its challenges. One of the key issues that we faced in the early 2000s was, at that time, the market was extremely tight that we operated in. There was significant demand on supply capacity, and basic commodities within that time. I can give the committee some examples. At the time that we issued our tenders globally, we had companies, boiler companies, turbine companies coming to South Africa and actually saying to us that they're too busy, they don't have the slots in the factories, that they would not participate within our process because there had been many cases of priority to the local markets. And that was the environment that we faced at the time. How do we secure capital goods and services for Eskom and for South Africa? The second part of this was how the contracting environment has changed and how the risk-sharing environment has changed. And at that time, we also had new thinking around contract management and risk-sharing that really was based on the global demand for new plant that was quite high. It was a supplier market. It was global, but it was quite limited. Suppliers were experiencing shortage of specific materials and components, and particularly suppliers are experiencing a significant constraint around engineering capacity. Fixed price contracts were just not able to be secured. The last one that was done, I think, was done at that time by Siemens. I think the one fixed price contract that was done at that time that's still running today is actually the nuclear plant being built in Finland. It's a brilliant contract. It just cannot get done. And is having pain for both the utility at that time as well as the contractors. And after that, nobody wanted to enter into fixed price contracts. And that obviously put increased demand on power plants and has led at that time to escalation of prices. It was certainly a seller's market and not the buyer's market. And that has significantly changed as we are now. But we had one issue that has been impacted by our decision to start so late. And that was reserve margin. We were all working against tight timelines. We had as a country no option but to start building, and there was very little time to start planning and doing all designs up front before we started actually securing our equipment. The second part of it is that in 2010 and 2010, we really got to the point where we actually put all our projects on hold because of the funding. There were no clear funding plans for how we were going to do our expansion. That has been addressed. And by October 2010, we actually signed off on a funding plan for Eskom. Eskom has put one in place. Not only does it have one, it actually has executed on that and secured 82% of its funding. So for what we have committed to, we will finish that, we have the money for that, and it's fully funded, and we're going full steam ahead in executing those projects. Safety for us is also very important. We knew that we had very tough schedules, but our firm belief is that safety is certainly the most important objective. I never wanted to be in a position where we've built all of this capacity and at the same time had a poor safety record. And today, certainly, I must say, within Eskom, and I would say within the South African construction industry, our projects have got one of the best safety records across the whole of South Africa. The development of skills for us is also important. We needed to make sure this program contributed to the skills development in our country, both as far as skills as well as manufacturing capability in South Africa. So today, we've localized over 50% of our spend, and more than 60 billion rand has been invested in South African companies. Skills remains a significant factor for us, and we must not underestimate the competition for skills that is fierce, both internationally as well as locally. And as we discussed, we needed to make sure we build our project capability. So as we then embark on these projects, not only did we execute that, to execute them, we also had to make sure that we build our project management capability, seeing that we've completed our last station, Majula, some time ago. Contractor performance became for us very evident as our projects started maturing. But certainly the capacity amongst contractors, and I must say it's both international and local large South African companies, where we had issues on capacity and competence at all levels to support what we were doing. So when a country don't execute infrastructure projects of the scale frequently, this impacts not only the owner, ourselves, but it impacts the whole economy and everybody else in the supply chain. And certainly our recent experiences has indicated really one specific key issue is around control of quality within our contractors. And that requires from us really building our capability ourselves to have greater supervision over all aspects of contractor work, which are things that actually contractors should do themselves. The labor relations within our work environment is a significant challenge. We have created a project labor agreement which was aimed to really standardize the rule on site, and this has been entered into by the contractors and their labor and their trade unions. There has certainly been, from our perspective, very poor adherence by both parties in terms of these agreements. That has impacted us significantly in terms of the disputes of labor on our sites. We have now decided as Eskom to facilitate a partnering approach between all of these parties, the labor, the contractors, to really improve this relationship and good commitment from everybody that that's what we will do. And we're still working towards and finishing this by the end of this month. Chairman, that gives us a perspective of where do we come from, the context in which we do all of this, the project capability that we've built, the lessons that we've learned, a sense of our capital expansion program and the lesson that we've learned out of that. And I'm going to ask Paul to then deeper in each of our actual projects that we still have under execution.
Thanks, Juan. Next slide, please. Let's just start with Medupi. We're here to give an update on the schedule. We are targeting that we have first synchronization of our first unit, which is Unit 6, by the end of this year. First synchronization means power to the grid. We're going to go through some of the risks we're still facing at this stage on Medupi and also explain how we're mitigating it. I must just say that we are currently having an independent review done of our schedule for both Unit 6 and Units 5 through 1, as well as the costs that we think we will have to incur. And we're also pursuing a vigorous claims strategy to make sure that where the accountability is with the contractors, that they pay for it accordingly. Next slide. Let's just go back to Medupi and look at it in the context of what Brian spoke about. Medupi from the beginning started off on the back foot without Eskom having an opportunity to do the proper front-end planning. And that's the reality of where we're at. When the construction started in 2007, there was a 15-month delay in the civil work which delayed the boiler contractor having access to their first foundations. And that was for a whole variety of geotechnical and other issues around the ground conditions that we had the site. Mm-hmm. At that stage, we referred to what we call Claim 17, where we allowed all the contractors a 15-month extension of time. That basically said that, and this was as of last year, that by July 2012, the first power of the grid should actually take place. When we sat here last year, that July 2012 time had pushed out to December 2012. And the major delay of those 6 months was due to the boiler contractor having design issues, structural steel erection issues, as well as logistic issues around the erection of the boiler. We were more confident that we would hit December 2012 because we actually had our pressure test, if you recall, last year in July of 2012, and normally in benchmark practice, from pressure test to first power is about 6 months. Subsequent to that, we've had a number of fairly serious setbacks on Unit 6. The first was that the boiler contractor continued to not manage their mechanical works appropriately. That cost us time. We had a strike for 3 months of this year from January to March. And then in November and December last year, I'm going to talk about them in detail, we had some serious quality issues that were raised to us, firstly around the welding by the boiler contractor. And then the control and instrumentation system, which is developed and basically the brains of the plant. It's a system that feeds all the pulses and all the information you need from all the plants in the unit and surrounding the unit and to make sure it works properly. And the factory acceptance test that was done in France for that failed and had serious consequences. So all of that has caused us to be, at this date, looking at a December 2013 first synchronization. So in total, if you add up the 15 months, that was a civil delay, and that was certainly communicated a lot before. We had the 6 months delay that we communicated because of the pressure test delays, and the latest delays, including the labor strikes, have taken. So all in all, that first unit from when we started is 33 months delayed. Next slide. This is a very important slide because this is going to be something that we're going to test ourselves on. This is something that we would communicate externally. This is something we're going to be communicating whenever the committee would like us to. And basically, from July, August of this year, we start the commissioning of Unit 6. And these are the key milestones you need to achieve in a commissioning process. From chemical clean to first fires, to blow through, to steam to turbine, to first sink. And so we are very open and transparent about these milestones and are quite comfortable to communicate regularly around these milestones. Next one. So just to put it again in a bit of a graphical slide, Claim 17 settled us on a July 2012 first sink. We had the boiler structural steel delays that I spoke about, construction slippage, and then the major issues that we've had around the welding issues. There's two welding issues, and the control and instrumentation has pushed us into a December 2013 first power. What does it mean for the rest of the units? We have spaced our program that we can achieve between each of the units around 6 months. It will be quite tough from Unit 6 to Unit 5, but as you get momentum, as you get better at what you're doing, as contractors get better, we don't see a problem in achieving all of those units by 2016, as we've indicated up there. It's critical to note that the first unit is obviously the most difficult, not only because we haven't done it for some time, but because all the balance of plant, all the major plant that you need around the boiler, which actually also applies to all units, you actually have to do it at the time you do the first unit. So it's important that the coal handling, the bulk fuel oil, all the auxiliary pieces of equipment need to be up and running. So that's what makes the rest of the units a little bit more predictable. So what are our issues currently in order? On the control and instrumentation, the software didn't pass its factory acceptance test. And there's a lot of cable pulling behind the control and instrumentation that needs to be done, and the contract is busy with that. In Bela, there's two welding issues. The first is that the wells, there's about 9,000 wells on boiler 6, need to be heat treated post-welding. And we were alerted in November and December that there were potentially some irregularities around the post-weld heat treatment and the quality assurances of the contractor that they were done appropriately. So they're busy fixing that. The welding procedures, the contractor did not get the adequate sign-off on the welding procedures in one of the factories that they used to do the factory welds, and that has caused them to go and have to get those welds requalified. They've had a number of those procedures actually failing, which means they have to do a combination of actually cutting out and redoing welds, as well as then heat treating some of the welds as well. So they're busy with that. Two of the other issues which are on the critical path, but not as much as the first two issues, is the electrical system. As I'll take you through, there's about there's thousands of kilometers of electrical cable that needs to be pulled, and we'll show you that. Because the boiler ship has been delayed, we have some access challenges because the electrical contractor should be in there putting all the electrics, and obviously we're having to work together with the boiler contractor to make sure they can get in. And then we have another issue, but you know, this one's under control, and that's to make sure that your fire water systems and your compressed air pumps are all routed and done, and again, it's about access issues. But for us, major issues as we sit today are around the control instrumentation, its related cables, and then the welding issues. Next slide. So on the control and instrumentation, what are we doing about this? We have our team of engineers sitting in Paris working with the manufacturer of the software, making sure it's done appropriately. We have sent the executive team, I've been myself, to Paris to make sure that on a regular basis we meet with the contractors to make sure they deliver what they need to deliver. On site, there's about 400 kilometers of cabling and about 200 cubicles required just for the control and instrumentation. And what we've had to do, and Brian alluded to it, there is no doubt that it's not just a South African issue. Globally, there is a complete lack of supervision control and adequate supervision on sites. And we've had to effectively man-manage a lot of the contractors, including this one, and make sure on a daily basis we watch their activities and make sure they achieve what they need to achieve. So it's a lot of input from Eskom. On the heat treatment itself, as I said, there's 9,000 potentially faulty wells out of the 53,000 on the boiler, and the boiler contractor busy going through those, correcting, repairing, doing what they need to do. They've brought in the extra equipment they needed. They brought in a specialized team from Europe to do this, and again, we're man-managing them on a daily basis in terms of activities needed to be done. On the welding procedures itself, they have now been fully tested, and where there's repairs required, we have agreed exactly what is required, so we have a detailed program from the contractor, and again, we're going to be managing it on a daily site basis to make sure that they get it done. We've had a lot of input from our engineering to make sure we're aligned with what needs to be done. On the electrical system, there's 400,000 kilometers of cable to be pulled in a generation plant such as this. If you think about that, that's a fair whack. There's a lot, and we, again, are having problems with the access because the boiler contractor should have been out of the boiler some time back, the control and instrumentation should have been out, and we should have been able to pull these cables. So we're just managing that access. Again, we've, as Eskom, recruited our own supervisory teams as well to make sure that this is getting done appropriately, and are pushing the contract on a daily basis. And then the plant mechanicals, the fire, water, air systems are going well at this stage. We did have some delays, but a lot of improvement in the contractor. Next. But let's just talk a little bit about supplier development and localization, which has been something perhaps that Eskom doesn't talk enough about. Because in the Medupi, Kusile and Angula, Eskom has created significant skills development and significant local spend in all of its projects.
and is a key backbone to everything we do. And it's not just about local procurement, it's local to site procurement and EEE procurement and job creation and infrastructure development. And those of you, and I know the committee has been, who've been to Abilali, can see what Eskom has actually done for the footprint of that region. Some specifics, and we have loads of information, but just to highlight some of the things we're doing that we've placed in the Lepalali and Waterberg region with local suppliers close to 1.7 billion rand worth of contracts related to Medupi. That's our to that. We are procuring about 202 million locally with 70% of procurement from black women-owned companies. As at the end of March, when we finished the strike and got everybody back to work, we had 16,800 people on site. That is probably the peak of our site, and as the civil work finishes, there will be demobilization. 43% of our workforce is from Lepalali. 72% of our unskilled and semi-skilled comes from the Limpopo province. 95% of the workforce is South African. We have less than 1,000 foreign workers on our sites, and those that are there are in highly skilled positions. Other than that, it's all local. And then 53% of our workforce are less than 35 years old. From the skills and entrepreneurial developments, our contractors, in terms of the contracts, the third contracts we've signed with our contractors, they have obligated to invest in skills development. And they have committed amongst all of them to train over 2,128 skills. There is an objective to train skilled people who can be employed in other areas. And we're busy through a program we call the Medupi Leadership Initiative. We're looking at what happens post-mobilization with our contractors. And one thing that has come out in terms of the new partnering agreement that we're signing with Lab at the end of this month is we need to pay a lot of more attention. We need the contractors to pay a lot more attention to skills development. And the goal is pretty simple, is that many of the people that work on our sites, this is their first job. Many of them were basic general workers. And what's very, very important for these people is that when they work off a site, they can get a certificate of competence from the work that they've been trained in. Whether it be a rigger, whether it be a scaffold, erector, whatever it is, they need to work off with a competence certificate. And we're driving the contractors very hard at this point, and in fact, Eskom has put a database together of all the 17,000 people on our site by person, and are tracking and making sure that they have been adequately trained and can work off our site with an adequate competency certificate. That's very important. The boiler manufacturers invested $24 million in the local training center. In infrastructure in that area, I know there were some issues when this committee visited, I think about a year ago, but we've done a lot of investment in Lepalali itself. We've rebuilt the sewerage system, electrical distribution systems ourselves. We're busy with seven rural clinics. We're funding six mobile schools, teachers and equipment, and obviously, when you visit, people will always be asking for more, and we do understand that. But there is a limit as to what we are capable of doing as well. And we have spent more than $2.3 billion in housing in Lepalali since 2007. But what have we done? I don't know, Brian, if you want to pick this one up.
Chairman, in terms of making sure that we deal with the issues I have asked that senior management, including Paul, spends time on site. We have a project team on site. We have teams in Legoat Park, but we wanted to make sure that we integrate that closely. We've put our engineering teams to actually start doing the pre-commissioning tests of the different systems. But more importantly, in putting our own executive there, was to get the contractors, the international companies, to pay particular attention to our projects. And we get the chief operating officers of these, particularly our two big contractors, plus Puna, the chief exec. So the big South African construction company's chief executives comes to Medupi every 2 weeks, and they come and look at their work, and they talk to their project team to make sure that that is done. So that is really just making sure we increase the management attention. As we've indicated, we've also put in quite a lot of processes around the review, independent review of our commercial approach that we're dealing with. I track this weekly. I get a weekly feedback report from Paul. We have established an EXCO and board subcommittee. The minister has mentioned that. That is done. It's in place. But we realized that we also needed to strengthen the human resource, the industrial relation management on site. And in that regard, we've asked all the contractors to deploy their best HR people to site and IR people to site. We have put our own HR executive on site to look at leading the partnership agreement and the replacement of the project labor agreement. We spoke about the Madupi Leadership Initiative. Lee, that was very important. That one of the legacies that I'd like to see out of each of these projects is that we have, certainly in the case of Mpopo, a sizable FEP college, that in the case of Mpumalanga we have the same coming out of these projects, and that when the people finish, they go into other projects that we need in that area, or for that matter, they go into the FEP colleges and come out as artisans that are fully trained. And the independent reviews, we've pretty much done all of that. The business case organizational structure, as we've indicated, has been reviewed. We're looking at our business case and our procurement packages and make sure that all of those are engaged. We obviously have funders. The project is funded globally through Export Credit Agency funding, through World Bank funding, African Development Bank, and we engage on a regular basis with our funders to make sure that they're very clear as to where we're at as far as the project is concerned. And those are some of the interventions that we've implemented specifically to drive. I must indicate that there's a lot of work. There's a mammoth task to get this done by the end of the year. But I can certainly give the committee the assurance that we are doing everything and making sure the contractors are doing everything to prioritize the work that needs to be done. Thanks, Kusile.
Yeah. On Kusile, again, I'd like to provide an update. So our target there is first part of the grid by the end of 2014. I want to talk through some of the issues we're currently facing on that particular program. The total schedule that I'm going to put up has been reviewed independently by an international organization, and their conclusion was it's achievable. And the business case that we presented many times before of 118.5 billion rand, excluding transmission and IDC, has also been independently reviewed and assessed as a reasonable cost. In Kusile as well, we've had delays since we started. Kusile started after Madupi. The biggest delay on Kusile has been funding. The Board of Eskom, as far back as 2009, put a moratorium on the packages of Eskom as we were going through our MYPD2 process, as Eskom did not have an adequate funding model in place. And that went all the way through post the MYPD2, where, if you recall, we were given 3 years of 25%. We had requested a lot higher. And until we had secured that funding plan, the 300 billion rand funding plan, which we've spoken about and presented that before, and that was only in October 2010, there was a total moratorium on placing any packages. So that caused significant delay in what Kusile needed to do. So we are where we are today. We are targeting first synchronization by December 2014, but if you look at the original business case, the first synchronization was supposed to be June of 2012, but with all those funding challenges, that was not the case. We followed a fleet strategy for two of the major contracts, which is the boiler and the turbine, and that meant some of the issues that the boiler contractor faced at Madupi they're facing at Kusile, but not to the extent that we've had it at Madupi. So some of the rail issues that we've incurred in Madupi have also replicated themselves in Kusile, but not to the extent that we've seen at Madupi. Next slide. So where we are is the procurement and the funding. You can see the delays that caused. We also had some quite violent site industrial action in 2011. And the boiler contract, again on this site, has been, although they learnt from their design issues that they didn't get right, and they've learnt a little bit about their structural steel issues, they still struggle. And one of our challenges is at the moment, at Madupi, we're at stop of our last boiler already. So we're doing 6 boilers at once, and at Kusile we're doing 3. So you're actually constructing 9 boilers at once.
Now, globally, that's nobody's attempting that at this stage, and perhaps only the Chinese. It's difficult. And when you have these delays in the program, you know, you're trying to share a very limited pool of resource. So currently our forecasts per our integrated program is showing a slippage of around 6 months from the December date. We still have time, and we've got an accelerated program in place and a mitigation strategy to bring that back to December 2014. Next. So using that at December 14, the way we negotiated Kusile, and it was part of our funding solution, is we needed to defer cash flows of Eskom out in October of 2010. And so your unit space is around 8 to 12 months between each unit as opposed to the 6 months at Medupi. So yes, it does give you an opportunity to accelerate it going forward, but you have to view in the light of it would be extremely difficult to be constructing 12 boilers all at the same time. So these are the types of challenges you have to face. That program, as I said, has been independently reviewed and assessed as achievable. So what are our issues currently on Kusile? Labor stability at Kusile in particular has been a real challenge. I think the process we're undergoing at the moment, we're doing Medupi and Kusile's partnering agreements at the same time. I think we've got a lot of traction. We're definitely on for signing at the end of this month. And in both Medupi and Kusile, I think Eskom were not part of the original project labor agreement. The employees of these contractors are the employees of the contractors. They're not the employees of Eskom. But what Brian and I came to learn, certainly in January of this year, is that Eskom has to take a far more active role because the project labor agreements were not being complied consistently by the contractors. And in many cases, and my own personal assessment is that the labor force was not being treated appropriately. And so we had to take a very active role, and we as Eskom will be part of that partnering agreement and make sure that everybody gets treated appropriately. Boiler erection I've spoken about, and then we have had some civil challenges that we're currently facing on some of the latter units at the moment. Next slide. Permitting challenges we're currently facing in getting water use licenses for some of our ash and gypsum disposal areas. And we've had some challenges around the liner systems that we had. So behind Medupi, some challenges, but all these challenges we think we can pull back. Labor, I've spoken about, making sure we get the contractors, if there's a wage rate to pay, it's paid consistently. If there's enough time to get paid, it's paid consistently. If bonuses get paid, it's paid consistently. Eskom will be implementing both Medupi and Kusile one wage bureau deal with us, as opposed to 300 contractors and their subcontractors each dealing with it on their own. We will make sure we've got a monitoring mechanism where things are done consistently in a standardized manner. Boiler erection I've spoken about, civil delays, particularly in the latter units, we need to get those out of the way, and then the coal and ash permits that we're still awaiting. Skills development significant, so you can see there that in Mpumalanga we've spent close to 2.8 billion already on local contractors in Mpumalanga. In industry development, you can see all the local industries that we've helped develop through this project and the local businesses. There's a contract academy that we've created in partnership with the University of Limpopo. And then there's a massive focus area on our local spend, in particularly the Kusile area. Next one. Our skills programs, you can see some of the, we track this actively, the types of skills programs and the bursaries that we've developed. And also some of the other areas. And we have similar at Medupi, as I said, we have reams and reams of information. We just try to give a different feel to it. Next one. On Ngula, again on the schedule, talk to you where we are, give you an overview. Has been independently reviewed, so what the schedule I put up to you today has been independently reviewed, assessed as reasonable and achievable, and the cost of 25 billion also as reasonable. Again, we've had delays in Ngula since the beginning. We've particularly had delays in the main underground civil works through the ground conditions we found there. But it's the 19th largest pump storage scheme in the world, and it's the largest underground cavern in the world excavated in Mudrock. It's a very, very challenging program,
It's four units of 330 megawatts, totaling 1,320. Next slide. Currently, we are intending commissioning all four of the units in 2014. And that well on track. What's going to be critical is that we can open up the waterways, because we'll have the units ready to start generating power, but we must just make sure that we can get the water from the top dam to the bottom dam and make sure we get all the accesses through. And that's our current biggest challenge at the moment. Next slide. There you can see that's our current target, and we are on track to achieve that. Late access has been one of our issues, and obviously the complexity of the interfaces, particularly in the underground works, making sure that the designs are all complete, and labor again. We have had labor unrest in this particular site, and we're constantly managing that. There's an example of some of the skills developments we've achieved. There's total employees of 3,277 at the peak of Ingula. That's gone down a lot. And the local to site, the people from the local area was 2,250. You can see some of these are the matter packages, and you can see that our local content targets in most instances have been exceeded significantly, as well as our expenditure on some of our other localization goals. In terms of our transmission, right?
Well, what I will do is on transmission give you a quick summary, as you have, the committee has got the slide and had those. If we go to slide 50, which the next slide just gives us a sense of the transmission network in the country, what are we working on. As we can see, we need to integrate the likes of Medupi into the grid, building lines to strengthen the Platinum Basin and into Gauteng, and then obviously the integration of not only within South Africa, but also future imports from the region into Gauteng. Angola needed to be integrated, that is done, actually Angola has been done, and as well as the integration into KZN. But what we've also indicated on this slide is some of the future expansions is not only done by Eskom, but also the rest of the country. The independent power producers, the potential areas where we have to build strengthening for future nuclear capacity in the country, as well as the renewable energy, particularly in the Northern Cape. So the Northern Cape networks will see significant strengthening in terms of transmission investment. The next slide just gives a very good indication that within the strategic integrated projects, particularly SIP 10, which deals with transmission integration, it spans all of South Africa. And all of this would then see the full integration and expansion of South Africa's transmission grid throughout the country. There are, in the transmission business that we have, a specific issue for us is that impact timelines really relates to approvals, environmental impact assessments, acquisition of land, water use licenses, and in many cases, as we indicated on that slide, can take up to 3 years to have many of these things resolved. We have a plan in place that obviously includes not only ourselves, but great support from our shareholder and many parts of government to really start addressing many of these things that needed to be done in making sure that we have water use licenses, our environmental approvals are done, access to land, which is a key issue, expropriation issues, which was needs to be dealt with. And then obviously in terms of transmission, obviously the one thing I would like to highlight is that the NERSA decision around MYBD3 certainly would require us to reprioritize our transmission expansion for the country. But that's work that we're doing with the shareholder. But similarly, in the case of transmission, the next slide gives an indication of our estimated development plan over the next 5 years, including the spend and the localization. But transmission is one area on slide 55 that pretty much South Africa has got the full capability to design transmission lines, networks, to supply most of the equipment and actually localize a lot of this. And we continue to expand our capability as a country to build and construct and design transmission networks. Chairman, I'd like to stop there. Hopefully that gives the committee an indication of the context with which we do this, how far we've come, the capability we've built up in terms of our own project issues, the specific projects and the issues that we've been facing with, giving you confidence as to how we're dealing with them. Certainly these projects are very important for the country, and they will be done. Like we have built them before, we will build them again and make sure that we have sufficient capacity to support the economic growth. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the presentation. I had to allow it to continue, but we're really running behind time, and I don't want us to eat too much into the transnet time. So without wasting any time, I'll invite members then to raise their, we'll go that way. It's Honorable Bauman, Dr. Puerna, Honorable Maren, Honorable Mike.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much to both of our presenters for the presentation, the update this morning. And I think let me start by congratulating Mr. Darmus on appearing on the after 8 debate after the budget vote, which I think concluded the budget, but in a very nice way. And I think very often we get so sort of bogged down in the negatives that we forget to see the big picture. And I think certainly this morning also one is aware of the huge amount of work that is taking place, you know, within Eskom and to the, and I think that speaks to the passion and the, you know, of the people who work there as well, and let us never forget that. However, having spoken about that, if I may just ask you, you know, I believe that at the heart, at the source of everything is this thing on the human capacity, and particularly as we've seen lately, the labor relations side of things can really put the cat amongst the pigeons. Can I understand, please, the difference between what you talk about in your slide 15 on the labor relations, the difference between the PLA, which seems to still involve everybody, and what you refer to as the partnership agreement, the PA, because there still seems to be the same people involved. What makes you so confident that now this is going to work better than the PLA? And then also just on the welding thing, you know, this is quite mind-boggling, these 9,000 welding points. And I'm taking it that it's 9,000 out of 53,000 that were faulty. I don't know if that's correct. But, you know, when you build a house, you have inspectors. And we always say NHBRC must be there every step of the way. So when the foundation is laid, the inspectors must inspect it. No use completing the house and then we find that something is not right. Way back with the foundation. Can I ask you, you know, are there regular inspections that happen? Because by the time everything has been completed and closed up, you then do have problems with access and getting in, and it does take much longer. So that's my question relating to that. And yeah, I think I'm going to leave it there because we are busy with the time.
Thank you, and I don't think we've done it in this platform as yet, but a happier 90th birthday for you at ESCOM. I think, thank you for putting it in perspective, that this policy of government, that policy is being funded, and officially you are now rolling out this huge capital investment rollout program, and you are in the forefront in South Africa, and that is a success story I think we must all celebrate. And thank you for your input and your team of making this a success. That's a first, just a remark. Can I ask, on your slide 22, 23, 24, those critical five areas, this program is going into 2019 of all the projects that you're busy with, but I think the next 6 to 7 months is going to be critical with Madupi specifically. And when you talk about the five areas, your slides, well, it's more strictly confidential, but it's a public platform, so maybe you can explain that one. But the five areas that need your intervention, and you spelled out your intervention, in your last column you say generally achievable. Can you just unpack for us what exactly does that mean? We understand it. We understand your challenges. But are you confident? We are 6 months away from the first synchronization. Are you confident at this point in time that we will be able to adhere to your intervention and you will be successful? That's the first one. Secondly, I think, Mr. Damas, you are on record the total overrun or the total delay period, if I understand you correctly, is 33 months in total. You all added up in Madupi. And you said a study will be completed about the cost of the overruns. Can I ask whether you've completed that study of the cost of these delays in Madupi? And if so, what is the total amount of these cost overruns? Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by also congratulating ESCOM for visionary leadership and particularly dispelling all the doubts that were there, the rumors and so on, that Mr. Thomas was going to leave, and Mr. Paul Flight was also going to leave. We would like you, gentlemen, together with your team, because of the leadership that you demonstrate. It was almost a near miracle that you put through this, helped by the assistance of the executive and the visionary TPE. So congratulations, you see, when there's an expression that when the going is tough, the tough gets going. So you didn't jump ship, run away and so on. And you go down in the history of the economy of this country as outstanding leaders to manage to help us through this. Because as we all know, electricity is the bloodstream of the country. Without that, the country just shut down. And we're very proud of you and want to encourage you as parliamentarians here that you are a cold face of things and you are hands on, number one. The PMC, the Project Management Center, that you are setting up fascinates me because it creates a model of putting together project management, not only for ESCOM but for the whole country, and I think it's the first. Because what has been happening, we've been having very different, various models of project management, this, that, just about what we thought, nothing consolidated. So you are actually institutionalizing it by having this PMC, the Project Management Center, not only for SELP, but for other businesses in the country. And that's an added value for a state-owned company to actually do a thing like to show leadership. And because the private sector is also going to buy into this and learn from you in the School of Excellence. Number two, also linked to this, DPE also has a project management office, the PMO. Now, I want to know what the nexus is between the PMO, which is conceived of by the DPE, and the Project Management Center. Right. That's the first one. Second one, you have agreed that around for 4,700 kilometers throughout the country. It's a big infrastructural grid. Now, on the other hand, you've got the fleet of power stations, numbering 27, all these power stations. Now, when all is said and done, the output of electricity that's going to be made, would that be accommodated in the whole grid, or are you going to need would we need to extend the kilometers of the grid beyond the 4,700 kilos? Now, the next point is, what question would the PPIs, the IPPs, independent power producers, what role do they play in this whole thing here? And what wattage do they contribute? Do they just buy from you? And how far are they in the program in generating their own electricity? I just want to clarify that whole scenario. That's a question for you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will be very short. On the slide number 8, this is quite a particular line, actually she doesn't have to go in. We stipulated that the low steel manufacturing quality has been there filled up with your procurement department as far as they allowed maybe some steel coming into the cell plants that is not up to standard. And I know the focus of this report today is infrastructure on the major infrastructure projects. Can you just in a very two or three sentences, give me just a very short summary as far as your infrastructure is concerned with electrifying, electrifying of households in South Africa in that direction as well. Thank you.
Honourable Remind.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm not really going to congratulate Eskom too much. I'm exceptionally worried, as you know I am and I have been for some time. And this report, I continue to be exceptionally concerned. I think all South Africans should be exceptionally concerned. Chair, the Medupi power station is exceptionally behind schedule. And I think that South Africans deserve better. We should have had a power station ready on time as per the original time schedule that was given to us. And it has been pushed back and pushed back and pushed back and left us. And Mr. Dams, please understand, I think the media likes to play you and I off against each other. It is nothing personal against you. It is an issue that I have with the situation that the country finds itself in at present. And that situation is that at very best we have a 3% buffer at any one given time. You yourself, Mr. Thomas, have said that if the South African public doesn't pull behind you 100%, we cannot keep the lights from the centre. That Eskom cannot do it on its own. And I think that these are exceptionally worrying things that we as South Africans are learning to just accept as part of the course. And I don't think it should be part of the course. Chairperson, there are things like civil delays at Medupi. What are these civil delays? We need some kind of elaboration on what these delays are, because we get the questions from the public. The public phone us in panic. Every time there's a power cut, regardless whether it's a transmission station that's exploded or anything of the sort, people immediately phone and they want to know, is this the load shedding that we've heard about? The welding problems. What kind of action have we taken against those companies? What kind of action? Because these people have set us back and embarrassed, not only Eskom, but embarrassed the country. And I don't think that we are putting severe enough penalties against these people who embarrass our country and, quite frankly, put our country at a huge amount of risk. Chairperson, the geotechnical delay that we experience, how sure are we that these geotechnical problems are all solved? Are we going to, in 6 months, have another delay because vibrations are causing foundations to shudder? How far are we with these things? Are we 100% sure that all of these geotechnical delays are okay? My biggest worry at Medupi and Kusile, Chairperson, remains labour unrest. And I'm so glad that Eskom agreed with us that there was a huge problem with the labour. We ourselves went there, Chairperson. We heard some of the problems going on there. Has Eskom employed mediators on site? Because, and I've said this time and time again, Medupi is its own city. And we need people on site so that when problems are identified, before they explode into these mass actions, we can take care of them. Because sometimes it's simple things that simply accumulate. And again, not always Eskom's fault. It's your contractor's fault. But then what do? They embarrass Eskom. And what kind of things have you put in place for that? Chairperson, and also our secure coal supply. Chairperson, this is something that gets brought up over and over again every time there's a strike with one of our coal mines. Chair, we spoke about the coal mines that were operating, supplying Eskom without valid water licenses. I hope that has now come to a complete conclusion and that we have made sure that all our coal supplies are legitimate and legal coal supplies. But also, Chair, I'd like to know from Eskom, in terms of wet coal, what have we taken action to ensure that never a situation occurs again where the coal supply to Eskom is wet and that the coal that is given to Eskom is actually of a standard that Eskom requires? Chairperson, then I must ask this because this is something that keeps
people... Honourable
Mayor. Chair, just my last point.
This is your fifth one. You're now going for your sixth one.
And it will be my final one. I promise, Chair.
I want us to speak with the rule of...
Okay, no, don't worry. Professor. I don't mind being silenced. Thank you, Chair.
No, I'm not silencing
Fine.
You. All members, you didn't go beyond the three questions. And I just allowed you because you are angry to go beyond...
I'm not angry, Chair. I'm concerned.
It's going to be the other one.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair, I'll be short, and if we have rather address all the honourable members' questions, then certainly we would provide that in writing to you if that's okay with you. Honourable Bowman has asked a question around the difference between the PLA and the partnering agreement and our sense of confidence around that. I can add a bit more, but what was very important for us is we must understand that we need to make sure we stay within the collective bargaining structures in the country. So we must understand we have many industries coming together at one site. All of that negotiates their collective bargaining issues separately in different industry structures. And what we needed on site was rules of the game between contractors and trade unions to spell out how do we make sure that things are consistent. Consistent application of accommodation, food, transport, work hours, payment methods, and many of those things. So that was the project labor agreement attempted to do. And everybody signed for that. Contractors, unions, industry bodies signed for it. I think what we're now getting to is a lot of lessons has been learned over the last few years as to how we can actually improve that. And in many cases, I think it had to do with how workers were treated. And many of this is not just the transformation of what's happening in the infrastructure, but also the lack of transformation that's happening in many private companies in Eskom, and then what you face on the surface. So the way workers got treated. And workers got thrown the book, which was Project Labour Agreement, and they really felt that their rights that they had within the work environment were impeded. And the intent of a partnering agreement was to take the lessons learned, to bring the parties together to reflect on the journey, and actually put in place greater sense of consistency on many issues. So we needed to get the contractors to up the game. We needed them to agree to, for instance, consistent payrolls, the way they deal with overtime, the way they calculate wages for workers, and many of those things have got learned that we're trying to capture in the partnering agreement. I think the sense of confidence really comes out of the process we followed to make sure everybody put the issues on the table and that we come up with something that everybody certainly agrees with, taking into account of the lessons that we've learned. I don't know if you want to just quickly add to that.
No, just to quickly add, and also to allay the members' concern, what we've done is, and you're right, it's the small issues that translate themselves into bigger issues. And we have, there were 9 historical grievances at Madubi. When you look at them individually, you actually say, well, what is this all about? There were 13 at Kusile. We sorted that. We brought mediators in. We led the process. We did it. We're leading the process for the partnering agreement. We will not distance ourselves again. We will ensure that the IR people of the contractors on site are the appropriately skilled people on site, not construction type people. We need people who can treat people with basic human rights. That's what we need, and that's what we intend doing. So there's no guarantees, but we're in a lot better position than when we started.
Another question around the welding. Very correct, 9,000 out of 53,000. And yes, the quality process has got very specific inspectorates in place and multiple levels of it. And it doesn't even start with us. It starts with a subcontractor and independent inspectorate, with the contractor and independent inspectorate, and then you would have what we call an independent authority. So if you look at many of our equipment we buy today, you sometimes see it stamped by a specific company that globally is renowned. We say this is the inspection authority that stamps and signs off. All of this has followed that process. And so we're waiting for the reports from our contractor to say what has happened. Why have we gone through all of this? And what was sophistication in how you've actually either not done the inspections or dealt with irregular issues? And that's what we're waiting for them to explain that to us. Going forward, we have, on top of that, as I said, indicated our inspection and improved our own inspection capabilities. So all of that has been in place by very, highly renowned, at least 4 tiers of inspections on any one. And it's gone through that process. So we're just asked exactly what has happened, and that's really what we're asking the questions now and waiting for the feedback. Honorable Kudnoff has asked a question around 5 critical issues. We indicate general achievability. We have engaged together with the minister, each of the contracts on the issues. They have all up to now given us in writing commitment that they will work towards achieving the year, end of the year. They have now given us resource schedules, so they actually break down the activity, how will I repair the house, how long will it take, what people I will bring in, all of that is what they've given us, and the work has started. So when we say generally achievable, from what they have given to us, yeah, it's generally achievable, but now they have to gain our confidence to say, will they deliver this amount? And that is really
ways why we do believe it's a big risk. So from where I sit, I don't think we should walk away and say it's all done and dusted, and we're working very hard towards the end of the year. I think there is a risk to that. I must be very clear and transparent to the committee. There is a risk to that. I am concerned whether or not we'll do it, but we are leaving no stone unturned to make sure that we deliver this. But we're really in the hands of these contractors to make sure this time around they actually deliver on their plans as you do. The issues around delay, I think there were three big issues as Paul has indicated. The first one deal with geotechnical stuff, I'll talk a little bit about that, and that is really the impact that we've had. And there were three geotechnical issues. There was an issue around the actual rock condition on site at Medupi. That has been resolved, it's been dealt with. So we actually dropped the whole station to the bottom rock and then built the station up, and that took time, and that was the right decision, and that's what we've done. The second issue is that our turbines, the foundations for our turbines had a new design that Eskom has not employed before. And we wanted to take adequate time to make sure that we signed that off and the South African construction companies could construct it. That took 6 months out of 15 months. The third issue in that first 15 months had to do with the seismic design issues. That has also been dealt with. We've agreed to that and has put that in place. That was the 15 months. So that was the first issue of Medupi. And because of the late decision to build the station, if we'd made this decision in 1998, we would have had the thing done now. And that is the time that we've paid, 15 months. But since then, it was really the contractors, particularly boiler contractors. Second delay around structural steel, and I'll touch on question that was asked, and now the issues that we're dealing with now. So we have done a study. We are awaiting the final results. We have indicated there would be an increase in the cost, because in this case, we have to spend money, because our contractors obviously would come to us. If the boiler contractor is delayed, or if delayed Eskom, we have to pay another contractor. But we have to pay that and then go back and then implement our remedies to regain our money and put the claims to those that should cost the delay and keep them accountable. Do you have any comments on that?
I'd like to give the committee 100% assurance that we have taken on the contractors in every possible remedy in the contract. We are the only next step is to terminate the contract. Now, the consequences of terminating the contract with a boiler contractor who's busy with their design on 9 boilers out of 12 would be catastrophic, because you will not get a boiler manufacturer to come in without their own design and to finish it off. So we are pushing the contractors in terms of bonds, in terms of penalties. They are suffering, and we're doing that to make sure that they deliver.
Honourable Mukwela has asked some questions around the project management model. We are working with the department. We're actually putting a platform in place, not only that the department can also monitor all the portfolios of projects within the SOE, so not only in ESCA, but also within Transnet and the other SOEs. So we actually have built the ESCOM platform, and the department will use the same platform to deal with that. There's a question on the grid. The grid in South Africa is 390,000 kilometers of large. So the 4,700 is what we've built over the last few years. And the answer is we will have to expand the grid over the next 20 to 30 years for what the country needs. The further nuclear, the renewables that you've mentioned. So we will build the grid, and the IDPs will produce the power, and we will connect them to the grid. And similarly, municipalities. So there is a need to extend the grid. And as we've indicated, one of the big issues we're now working through is the impact of the MYPDC decision on the expansion of the grid going forward. The role of the IPPs play, I think they will produce over the next few years just over 3,000 megawatts of capacity versus Eskom's 42,000. And the municipalities, the big municipalities, does have capacity, generation capacity, and we are contracting City Power, City of Tshwane, and then also there's some capacity in Cape Town that we're contracting. There was a question from Honourable Mike Marais around the low steel manufacturing quality and our procurement issues. Really, the issue was around the ability of large construction companies in the country to be able to manufacture and do detailed design on the steel. So not the quality of the steel, but how does the steel fit together? So to give you an example, if you have thousands of pieces of steel and you have to put them together like a big puzzle, and they come together at one site, you need to know which piece fits into which piece. Now, our companies don't get that right. It takes months, and that is really what we're referring to. And also the way they design the steel. If you bring two pieces of steel together and you put a bolt through them, it's very difficult because the holes must really align If you change the design and put two flanges on the side, it's a lot easier. Now, little things like that is the capacity that we've lost in it. And that is the quality issues that has happened in big South African construction companies that has led to our delay. And those gives you the sense. So hopefully that electrification, very quickly, as a country, we had 85% universal access in South Africa. Last year, we have done 144,000 electrification connections. So the target that we were given, we've just closed our books, we'll release our results pretty soon. We have met the target that was given in the country. I think last year we've done 144,000 connections, new households. Honorable Michaels has raised quite a few issues. Really, from our perspective, I think we are working very hard around making sure that these projects get delivered. What we do have is we have projects, and they're being built, and everybody is on the ground. We're not planning them, we're not talking through them. I must give you the assurance that as Eskom, there is no company in South Africa that wants to expand that has asked Eskom for capacity that we said no to. We have in our pipeline over 5,000 megawatts of requests from companies who want to invest in new projects. All of them has been processed and has been given budget quotes because we're busy with our expansion to make sure. So none of this is really impacting the country's investment. I've not seen that. We've not said no to any company that wanted to invest in the project. We have a list. We have come to talk every Friday morning. I'll sit down with all our blocks, companies, CXX, and we'll talk about their specific projects. You raised quite a whole range of issues around the buffer or the reserve margin. I think we have asked South Africans continue to ask them over peak periods to make sure that we all save electricity. Because that's when we use a lot of electricity. That is when you reflect the margin. And I must say to you, we've had no load shedding in South Africa. Even this winter, after I've presented to you, we've had no interruptions. We've had no blackouts. And what's happened in the Westland in Johannesburg has got to do with cable theft. It's got nothing to do with Eskom. Really, it's something that we all have to work towards. So every night we've met the demand. And South Africans have responded, companies have responded, and my own team in Eskom has responded. And some of the outages I said to you, I had to do 9. I think by now 3 of them is done. And we will finish what we said we would do this winter, and we will work with South Africans. But I must say to you that for 20 hours of every day in South Africa, there is more than enough capacity in the reserve margin actually get to such an extent that we have to dump energy at night. So from the mornings to 5 o'clock, the country has got more than enough energy. From after 10 o'clock, the country has also got more than enough energy. And the reserve margin actually increases. It is that peak period. And that is not an Eskom issue in a power system. It's actually a benefit for the country not to generate expensive capacity at the time. If you save the capacity, it's cheaper for the economy. And that's really the effort that we're working on. The issues around civil, Medupi civils are done. And one of these days, it's finished. We're busy building a large boiler at Medupi. The civils are pretty much done. There's some work to be done. There's some issues at Kusile that our civil contractors must deal with. You've asked actions against the contractor, we'll respect that. I can give you assurance all contractors have dealt with in terms of the contract equally and fairly. We will leave no stone unturned. Whether now, and this is going to go on for a long time. Make no mistake. There's still going to be a long issue about us making sure we follow this through right to the end. Now we have to all focus not on blaming each other. My focus is to build these stations. That's what I have to focus. I can kick these contracts as much as I like. I need them now to finish this. That's what we focus on. Don't put away our contractual remedies. That we will do. And yes, we're going to have long legal battles for a long time, which has happened in big companies and it's happened globally. And it's happened in Eskom before. I can give you a sense. When Majuba was built, the last station of Eskom's 27 stations, it started in 1983. At the end of Eskom's peak of project management and capability, it's learned from 20 stations. It started in 1983. The first unit went into commission in 1996. I think we're doing pretty well at Medupi if we get this done as we've indicated. And this is not unique to what we've seen before as to what we experienced. And you can go to Germany today, you'll find exactly the same thing. You can go to Finland today, you'll find exactly the same thing. It's a global issue that we're all dealing with. And I can give you the assurance, we are certainly doing everything to make sure that we do this. But South Africa must understand. We have a plan and we're busy executing. We're not a country talking about what we're planning. We're actually busy doing this. And I think I have dealt with the labor issues. I agree with you, the labor issues is important. It is crucially important for the whole of South Africa, whether it's coal, whether it's this, any of our industry. And I think we as South Africans now have to understand that we all have to work together to look after the interests of the economy, because that way we'll create the jobs, we'll deal with poverty, and we'll deal with issues that we need. And yes, we have appointed mediators. And yes, this is about contractors. You know, the issue here is this issue of transformation. You have a worker that goes to a supervisor and says, I've got a problem with my payslip, and get chased away. It's not right. It's not right. And that is the culture that's been created. So it's not just an issue of this. So now you're asking us to not only deal with the labor issues, but we have to transform and go to companies. I personally met with the chairman of the company. He meets with the chief executive of South African construction companies to get them to address this issue of relationships, this issue of how do they transform and how they deal with the workforce from that perspective. I think the issue around coal, we've discussed that we've got no wet coal issues, but enough coal stockpiles actually for the first time. And I'm very proud of my team. Last week, they did 50 days of coal stock across the fleet of Eskom. We've not had wet coal issues. We've had some very innovative issues around spraying coal or chemicals. But if you've got enough coal, you do. We still have coal quality problems from the mines. And we will deal with that. And we'll work with the mining industry and the mining sector to address it. Chairman, I know it's not the 3 minutes that you've asked for, but I thought it's important.
Input. Thank you so much for the presentation I gave Mr. Thomas and Mr. Fahati. I also like to thank members for their invaluable input in this discussion. Eskom made excuse.
Have you got a card?
I've got your card.
You have.
I just have
a card. Cooker didn't come up much, did it? I just can't. I can't take the cooker thing in. I don't know if you can create new worlds. Ports grow naturally. They happen either on a river or historically people like it or
natural bay.
I'm still happy. It's a bit like Americans invading Japan, building Midway in the middle of the Pacific. You know, there's a feeling of this is man-made. This is going to be a rush, the Transnet one. Yeah, you can't put Transnet and thing together. You know, that reaction of me, as an outsider, seeing Transnet and Eskom together was to presume they were going to talk about coal.
Well, this is short, so this is not us.
Yeah, well, you've got a problem because you're trying to double it all the time. Ah, good. That's a transplant. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, yourself?
Yes, he or she will. Can, oops, who's that? Linda Ensor. Ah, put it back. I know where she is, and that's where I was going to be. Who will be presenting for them today?
I'm just a virtual.
Sorry, who?
A virtual prime minister.
Advantage, really, aren't you? I tend to forget that, you know. And a lot of older people do. That a whole new generation
has come
through. And they don't even know who it was. Such an argument in Atlantic Economics in the economic affairs yesterday.
Good morning,
ladies
and gentlemen. Good morning again to those of you that are greeted earlier.
opportunity to stop the confusion and get the race.
We won't do any introduction. I think we have met, I think most of us here have met. So we're running behind time. We have to be done by 1:45 with this presentation. I'm going to request Mr. Malefe and his team to try and assist us. Yeah. Over to you, Mr. Malefe.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, one out of little time,
yeah.
What
was that? So as you know, just to recap on the market demand strategy which we announced last year, 300 billion rupees left in investment program over 7 years to fund rail, port, and pipeline infrastructure, to increase operational efficiencies, and productivity, enable regional integration, enable economic growth, create jobs, and create regulatory certainty, and drive research and development in the deployment of new cutting-edge technologies. A couple of weeks ago, the minister made a speech, and he referred to certain things in his speech. He referred to the procurement of 1,064 locomotives for general freight business. The tender process is currently underway, and this will increase general freight business capacity from 80 million tons to 170 million tons. He talked about the countercyclical approach to funding capital, our financial performance, creating opportunities for funding during the economic cycle, to stimulate the economy and create capacity. He talked about the oversight of the board subcommittees, and in this instance the board acquisitions and disposal committee oversees capital acquisitions. And he talked about next generation supplier initiatives. In this program, we target specific procurement events and focus on strategic programs to small and medium enterprise development, and we actively promote industrialization and technology transfer. By December 2011, our capital expenditure was 14.4 billion. By December 2012, between December 2011 and, sorry, by in the 9 months from March to December 2012, we had spent 90 billion, which is about a 32% increase to prior year during the same period. So although we had spent 14.4 billion by last year in December, this year we had spent 19 billion. Some divisions have had underspent against the approved budget. The first one was the pipelines. I don't think we should be very worried about pipelines after the big brouhaha of the overspending in pipelines, but we had spent 1.4 billion less in pipelines. Freight rail had underspent by about 1 billion by the end of December, and Ports Authority by 680 million due to the purchases of tugs being behind schedule. And then the port terminals had underspent by 266 million. The money had been spent on the key projects that are underlined here, infrastructure maintenance, locomotive maintenance, wagon maintenance, expansion of the coal line, acquisition of locomotives, acquisition of 100 new diesel electric locomotives, Cape Town container expansion project, TPT container handling equipment for Devon container terminal, and the new multi-product pipeline where we have spent 1.6 billion. I will ask Mr. Tomo Mayroka to talk about the locomotives that are in production as well as the locomotives in pre-production. Tomo Mayroka is the acting chief executive of Transnet Engineering. The executive group executive Transnet Engineering is at Harvard Business School finishing a course. I think we'll be back early next week.
Thank you, sir. These are the locomotives that we refer to.
first one on your left there, the 110 class 19 heat locomotives. They have been delivered already. They were built by DCW. They are for the coal line, basically to drive the volumes on coal line. The beauty about them is that the induction of these locomotives, they improved the availability and reliability. In other words, supporting then the idea of the drive for more volumes there. And again, they have the ability as well to credit electricity back into the power grid. They're using the energy that, because they come from the top, the potential energy down, and they plow it back into the grid, which then means that they are running more efficiently than any other locomotives that we have. On the localization side, so we've actual spend is about $1.3 billion, and that is a commitment that we've entered to with the supplier. The next one is a 100 class 43 diesel locomotives. These were produced in our factory in Goodesport, mainly for the GFB line. The service the steel, domestic coal, and magnetized cement. All 100 have been delivered, and 95 have been accepted. The remaining files are going through the commissioning stage. And the CSDP commitment, actual is about 952 million that we got out of that program. On the wagon side, as you can see there, we've been building these wagons also to support the volumes. The jumbo wagons on your far right, for the coal line, 1,236 have been built, as well as the CR-17s, 10-80, the flatbeds, as well as the car wagons, the ones that are in the middle, so to transport the vehicles. Thank you, Chair.
To talk about it a little bit, this double deck locomotive double deck locomotive here has been designed by Transnet Engineering. It can carry a double deck of cars, vehicles, sedans, but the middle deck can be adjusted up and down to take 4x4s or combis. We have started building it. We started production of about seven of these a week, one a day, seven a week that we are now manufacturing. We have a small backlog with the automotive sector, but we think that once these come into line, as soon as a train is ready, which is about 50.
Yeah, we normally take about 20 wagons from the workshop.
20 wagons for the workshop for a train set. We will then put it onto the line. We are just awaiting approval from the rail safety rail regulator, but we do not think that there will be a problem with that. In the past, I had indicated they don't have a problem with it, and that is why we've gone into production. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I will ask Mr. Councillor Gregor, representative for 10 minutes, to talk about the container business.
Just on the slide that we have up at the moment, the first item there refers to the re-engineering project, which we have been engaged with at our Durban Container Terminal. This is the continent's busiest container terminal in Durban. And the main purpose behind this re-engineering project was to increase capacity in Durban by creating additional stacking area, additional reefer points for reefer cargo that are handling at the terminal, and to build out DCT or Durban Container Terminal to deal with increased volumes that we're handling through the terminal. Significant progress has been made with that project now. In fact, if you visit the Durban Container Terminal, one can see the extended stacking area that has been developed there. The next item refers to the current initiative that Transnet is looking at in terms of additional
expansion of container handling capacity in the Durban area, and this is the acquisition of the old Durban International Airport site. And the plan there in the future is then to develop a container handling terminal, but also other terminals as well for the handling of other types of commodities like bulk and cars and the rest. So that will be a multi-commodity type of development in its end state once the new port has been developed at the old Durban International Airport site. The next item refers then to the recent acquisition of 7 10-lift ship-to-shore cranes that we acquired in Durban. 3 were delivered in November last year and 4 earlier this year. And these are the first of their kind at our terminals, the first of their kind certainly in the Southern Hemisphere. There's no container terminal anywhere in the Southern Hemisphere that has deployed what we call tandem-lift ship-to-shore cranes. These are cranes that have the ability to be able to lift 4 20-foot equivalent units or small containers, 6-foot containers, off and on to a vessel. And this is going to result in significant improvements to productivity and to speed of handling of the vessels that we receive at the container terminals. In fact, if you visit Durban, these have really changed the skyline in Durban. These are a huge tandem lift ship-to-shore cranes that we've now commissioned and are fully functional in the terminal. Moving on to Muha Container Terminal. Muha, I think, is really one of the success stories within our terminals business within Transnet. This terminal commenced operations in October of 2009, and the level of growth that we've seen there has been quite phenomenal. It has, in fact, outstripped a lot of our expectations in terms of the growth that we'll be seeing. In fact, a recent report on growth year-on-year between February last year and February this year has reported Muha Container Terminal as the fastest growing container terminal in the world. So, and this has been supported by the fact that we've been continuing with investment in the facilities at that terminal with deployment of yard cranes in the form of RTGs and also container handling ship-to-shore cranes that have been deployed at the Muha Container Terminal. Cape Town is also a project which is quite far advanced in terms of the expansion of the container terminal here. 6 cranes are fully deployed, fully functional here in Cape Town. At the moment, we are currently nearing completion of the stacking area work in terms of 10 meters of quay wall that are remaining for construction. Once those 10 meters are completed, there's 2 additional cranes that then will be deployed at the Cape Town Container Terminal, bringing the full complement there to 8 ship-to-shore cranes for the Cape Town Container Terminals. So if you look at just the full complement of container terminals that we operate in Durban, the new one at Port of Muha, and also here in Cape Town, there's been significant investment in terms of handling equipment and increasing capacity at these terminals to enable us to be able to handle increased volumes as they come through the terminals. Thank you.
If I can add my own 2 cents here, Muha's growth was 84.6% in 1 year, and the recent port publication said that in fact there is a world record in growth in 1 year for a container terminal. And the 7 tandem lift ship-to-shore cranes has increased the North Quay productivity from 18 crane moves per hour to 34, and we think 34 moves per hour, which means that we move over 34 boxes in 1 hour as opposed to 18 in the past, and we think that this can go to 50 as soon as our people have been trained and are used to operate this crane faster later on. I will ask Mr. Mlamli Buthelezi from Freight Rail to deal with the heavy haul export lines.
Right, starting with the with the export airlines.
So Mr. Mlamli Buthelezi is the Chief Operating Officer of Transnet Freight Rail. Mr. Gama, who's the executive, is still at Transnet. He's just delivering a paper at the rail conference in Singapore. Just before we start the rumor that Mr. Gama is not there anymore.
The close to 50 million tons of iron ore here is premised on more locomotives that we are deploying in the system.
the further studies to look into more different routes to allow more trains to pass the other intersection. And those are the studies that would also enable us to go to the 82 million tons with with iron ore, coupled with the third tiller that we will be procuring for the Port of Sardana. So that becomes a central, a big project in terms of the capacity expansion on the iron ore line. With the coal line, there is currently the project to what we call debottlenecking and standardizing the systems. And that is basically to create, we're commissioning a balloon as we speak. The coal line has been on shutdown for the past 2 weeks. And it's being commissioned now, annual planned maintenance shutdown. And we're putting an additional balloon in the yard in Emelo to allow the movement of trains within that yard to be much more efficient. Also, coupled with that is investment in some of our systems, electrical systems, you know, as as well as signaling systems, again, where we've experienced a lot of breakdowns and failures in the recent past. Also, we're beginning to question the issue of do all the trains have to stop in MLO? Because we have this in mind, there are more than 40. It all converges in MLO. Then you build 200 wagon trains that go to Richards Bay. So one of our key projects is the reduction of cycle times for these trains, which currently sit at around 60 hours. You know, and we're saying that some of the trains do not necessarily need to stop in MLO, and which is a project that we are also commissioning now as part of the optimization, and which we should see reduce the cycle times significantly to about 40, 41 for 2 hours. And this is part of the, as I said, the efficient improvements that we are investing on as we speak on the coal line, and that should take us to the 81 million tons.
And I will ask the group executives transit pipelines to talk about the multi-product pipeline.
Thank you. The multi-product pipeline, the construction work that still remains is in terms of the Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. Terminal 1 is the coastal terminal and Terminal 2 is the inland terminal. Both of those construction work are still in progress and on track as of December. The pipeline that has been commissioned is the 24-inch trunk line from Durban to Jameson Park. That was commissioned in January 2012. And the 316-inch lines were commissioned prior to that in 2011. To date, we've transported approximately 2.5 billion liters of diesel in the 24-inch trunk line. And there has been no security of supply issues thus far. The flow rate that the new multi-product pipeline currently operates is 500 cubic meters per hour. The intended flow rate will be 1,000 cubic meters per hour once the Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 are complete. And we've achieved a good DI record on both those terminals. Thank you.
Sure. So this, in short, our capital achievements by December 2012 on the oil line. We've instituted a new longitudinal rail stress management system and an ultrasonic broken rail detection system, which is ahead of the trains. We send an ultrasonic machine on the rail line to detect if there are any cracks, because if there is a crack, there is going to be possibly a derailment. So we can then stop a train before it actually comes. So this is... the distance of the oil line is about 500. No, the detection is like a small vehicle that goes on the railway ahead of, I don't know if you want to talk about it. These are the engineers.
Yes, so it's the ultrasonic inspectors that travel on the rail, and we put them before every train that goes on the online. That it inspects if there's any cracks that might result in broken rail, which could be catastrophic. So we do that 100% for all the trains that we move on the online.
This is the number of derailments significantly. Yard safety, we have instituted points, automatic points in Beaconsfield, Emelo, Bayhead, and we are busy with 14 signs. We the Cape Town container terminal, we have extended paving, as Carl has already said, and we are using the best concrete to extend even further paving. We're using deck and pile methods to stabilize key walls. Deck and pile is that inside the water we put some piles and a deck to help with the stability of the key walls, and this has been done at Cape Town container terminal. The Durban Harbour Entrance Widening, DHEW, the sand bypass system to replenish Durban beaches is completed. There is excellent in engineering and design and civil works, innovation technologies through control systems and green technology. The Durban Harbour Entrance Widening project is now complete, so the harbour is now wider. And the expansion of the manganese line, 5.5 million tons, the cross loops have been extended to accommodate the 1,200 meter trains, which is 1.2 kilometer trains. The Kimberley to the R line has been doubled. The line was operating as a single line, so we have rehabilitated the second line to make sure that that also works. And the Hot as Hell, or Hot as Hazel, has been reconfigured to handle more trains. This is a historical, this is a capital expenditure going forward, and the jobs impact analysis of the capital investment plan. I don't know, it's Suzette Potter, Annette Potter. She's an acting group HR manager. The HR executive is currently in Canada with the labor movement to study the bargaining systems in especially rail. They are currently in Canada with the unions.
In terms of the job impact analysis of the capital investment plan, as demonstrated in the diagrams that you see there, we're looking at direct as well as indirect footprint across several years up to 2019 and 20, aligned with that. That also informs our permanent as well as fixed term contract requirements internally in the organization. And if you go to the second page after this page, you will also see that in the past year, Transnet has also employed additional 5,000 positions into the organization. We've also provided a diagram there in terms of the percentage of female versus male employed during the period, as well as respective areas, as you can see, Africans, Indians, whites, as well as colored, representing those numbers. As part of our job creation drive, we're also in a position at the moment where we have started developing what we call a strategic workforce plan that will enable Transnet to focus on the specific skill requirements to assist us in going forward and taking us to the targets required by the NDF. In terms of that, we have in the past years continued by increasing our skills development programs. And at the bottom of that graph, you can actually see focusing on our numbers of engineering trainees. Those are bursars. And at the moment, we are carrying about 460 bursars that is will complete their studies year by year as we're going forward. The objective, as you can see there, then is to have an annual intake, of which the past 2012 was, the achievement was 122. In terms of trainees, technician trainees, that is a critical skill in our organization. They also come into the organization as soon as they qualify. The organization will back them up. As you can see, the objective there was about 300, while we've exceeded those numbers. With regards to artisans, we've created the Central Transnet Engineering School, where we actually develop and train all our apprentices. be sure that we distribute the according to the demands of the organization. Our target was 500, and as you've seen, we already had an additional 925. On average, we actually, the objective is to have approximately 2,000 apprentices in our organization. And in total, Transnet employs approximately 4,500 artisans. Sector-specific trainees, that refer to other sectors such as in the training environment, where we actually focus especially on training systems or OLEs in our course environment. If I turn the page to the next slide then, you will see that human capital going forward, if we look going forward in terms of all the specific elements of our workforce currently carried there, we've got approximately 58,000 permanents, 8,900 fixed terms, and a total of 67. The objective is then to grow those workforces up to the year 2018-19 to approximately 76,000. As depicted on the previous slide also, the mix will also indicate the plan intakes associated with critical skills, referring to those in the engineering, technical and artisan, and especially as well as our protection officers, that will assist us in closing the gap with regards to skills. Below that, our training costs are depicted, and you can see that for the 12-13 financial year, Transnet spent in the vicinity of 840 million rand towards skills or towards training. And as we're improving our systems, that figures will become very, very real, and the objective is also to align that with our future requirements, which is the year that we currently face with 5%, and then we see that we'll ease it out because our workforce are picking up and our fuel density will increase as we move on in time. Thanks.
If I can just add on the question of representation of women. At Group Exco, we have increased the female representation from 10%, it is now at 37%, and by July this year, we will have 50% of our women at Group members of Group Exco being female. The same target has been set in all the operational divisions for the extended Exco to have 50% female representation, and we hope that it will be cascaded down through the organization as the 50% be a target for Transnet. Just to add on the protection officers, it may be alarming to see that the increase in the number of protection officers. We are in social security, and this has paid off huge dividends, especially during 2012-2013. As we found that our security that is resourced is much more dedicated. They've been deployed in hotspots, and we have been able to reduce the number of incidents related to crime, cable theft, as well as theft of containers quite significantly. But I can bring the statistics to share how the committee is. Chair, I'm going to ask Mark Greg McDonald to talk about the historical spending on the economic empowerment and CSDP and capital expenditure. Mark Greg McDonald is a group executive for planning at Transnet.
I think the large jump in the capital expenditure to start with has really been a different approach that we took about 2 years back, where we assessed the demand for our services versus the capacity that we were creating. And that resulted in basically the design of the MDS strategy, which was a significant jump. So the capital expenditure, you can see, has jumped quite significantly. And there's an entire department within procurement that focuses on triple BE spend and supplier development. And I think the achievements in that area have been pretty well advertised. I think Transnet's got some of the most visible contracts where we are getting supplier development involved. The new locomotive tender, it's currently in progress, that's one of them. I think that's all I need to comment there.
Martin, can I also talk to this slide? This is really just an adjustment slide showing the 300 billion on the left was the India strategy, the one that we've advertised, everyone's aware of. But as we move on, we're now in the second year of it, and there's obviously a rolling plan. So if we look at the next 7 years in our corporate plan, which hasn't yet been advertised, but it's been approved by the Department of Public Enterprises, the seven-year capital spend from, in other words, year two through to year eight, compared to the original year 1-7, is not showing any reduction. It's actually increasing to 307 billion. So it's really just a slide showing how we've adjusted from the original 300 to 307.
Chief, I can emphasize this. What this slide means is that although we started last year planning to spend 300 billion over 7 years, so the first year is over. The first year is over, but now we've added another year in the 7 years, and now it's no longer 300 billion over 7 years. It's 307.5 over the next 7 years. So when we roll it over and add an additional year from, and say this is year one, it's 307 billion. But if it is from year, if this is year two, and we're talking about 7 years, it's still the 300 billion that we had planned to spend in the last year. So the capacity that has been created with this spending and that will be created in the future, on the coal line, we had the existing capacity of, we've invested 32 billion, we had the existing capacity of 71 million tons per annum. Over the next 7 years, we will create an additional 26.5 million tons, and the future capacity will be 97.5 million tons, and we will be utilizing 100% of the capacity by 2019-2020. On the ore line, it was 58.7 million tons, it will go to 82.5 million tons, and we've utilized 100% of the capacity. General freight rate, it was 85.2 million tons, and this will be increased to 180.3 million tons per annum, and we'll take 100%, we'll use 100% by 2019-2020. Maritime containers, we had capacity of 5.4 million TEUs. This will be increased to 8.1 million TEUs in the terminals, and we think that by 2019-20 we'll be using about 79% of the capacity. And bulk, 90.1 million tons, which will be increased to 127 million tons, and we'll use 100% of that. And the MPP is currently at 4.4 billion liters per annum. This will be increased to 8.7 billion liters through the pipeline. And in 2019-20, we think that the customers will use about 87% of the capacity. This will, over time, increase to 100%. This is just if you break down the spending over the next 7 years by corridor. We'll spend about 600 million on the Maputo corridor, about 52.7 billion on the Richards Bay, Johannesburg corridor, which is the port and the rail Johannesburg to Richards Bay, for 2.5 billion on the Devon Johannesburg, and the South Corridor, which is East London, Moha and Port Elizabeth, about 32 billion, Cape Town 5.3 billion, and Sishen Saldanha Line, 33.2 billion, including the port. I'm going to ask Mlamli to talk about these railways that we are doing, that, the railway network to Richards Bay and to Devon.
I think I'll start with the this one. If I have a talk, which is the water area, and we call it a provide a few, three main phases to it. Firstly, it is the link from the Palame to the coastline of Botswana. Approximately 70 kilometers of shore that we need to create to get across to those countries, bearing in mind that there is more coal that is in the ground than it is in the water. And that connects to the existing network that can come down through Tabafindi and Rustenburg Pyramid Farm. So this is one thing where we are basically busy with preliminary studies at the moment here going into feasibility level one on this one. And secondly, it is the strengthening of the existing line. which you can find us on the BNB.com. That line handles three trains in each direction per day. And the web that we just commissioned is basically at a place called Masaba, just next to the Panhandle, that enables this line handling six trains in each direction per day. It's a passing day. And then there will be certain work to be done on it to be able to handle longer and bigger and heavy trains. And then the third very big leg of the project is building a head haul line that basically comes out just south of Tarabindi and goes all the way to there by Auckland, connecting to Elano and all the way to Richardson. But this is between 300 and 400 kilometers of line, just to give you an idea. Although we are not at the level where we decided that the route of it. The work that we are doing on the existing line is at level 3, and the work that we are doing here is just completed to the level 2. So that's the line coming out of the water. And then there is the flood rail link line, which is from the in South Africa, in Malala, going to a place called Tsitsongoto, in Swaziland. About 145 kilometers of line there. We've just finished with the level 3. This line, we're looking at about 2019 to have it built. And here as well, we're looking at about 2018. To have the rail link, as we call it, built. So these are the key projects that we are very busy with in feasibility studies, and doing what we call gate reviews after commissioning, feasibility tool, where you go to the next level with unlocking codes for the function and the system. So that's where we are. Sure.
Yeah. Okay, on the export coal line.
Sorry, I touched on it, I think very quickly. I spoke about simplification and standardization of the export line, because remember, there's a lot of complexity that we have in the system. There's alternating current, there's direct current, so we are buying locomotives that are able to traverse different types of electrical supplies. And also, doing work around the MNO yard, which is the hub, to reduce dwell times, ensure the trains go in there efficiently and count, and also, upgrading the electrical network as well as the signal system quality. And then the 96-97 million ton expansion, which to now dealing with the big bottleneck called the overflow tunnel, which is a single line and it's a tunnel. About 4 kilometer tunnel. If something goes wrong in that tunnel, we all can. So the intention here is to build another tunnel, and make the coal line be double all the way, between Elano and Richardson. and then yes, we have more yard work and electrical upgrades and substations. And the continuing acquisition of locomotives 1980, as I said, the traverses both AC and DC in terms of electric. And then, fixing the infrastructure as we have it now, rail replacement, new locomotives, new wagons. And then some of the upgrade work in our own 10 ACs.
Okay, thank you. And just talk about the key initiatives on the export online for the Sicilian Saldana. Capital investments for the 7-year period is to increase capacity to increase capacity to 82.5 million tons, and scope entails the construction of new loops, import rail track, Eskom power upgrade, and wagons. And also increasing basin capacity at the port of Saldana, and the procurement of two additional tippers at the port of Saldana at the cost of 4.9 billion. Some of the projects are the acquisition of locomotives as well as maintenance that will be capitalized. General freight business, these are the projects under the general freight business, manganese expansion, locomotive acquisitions, wagon acquisitions for 17 billion, locomotive upgrades for 3.6 billion, wagon upgrades for 5.1 billion, capitalization of infrastructure and property refurbishment of CTD, which has already started nearing completion, and the upgrade of the optic fiber cable network. As we are building railways, we also put in under the railway optic fiber that we will use in the future for the country. So that it is, we expand the network. So as wherever we dig, we also put in optic fiber, and we will use it between ourselves and broadband in front. This is the locomotive acquisition program for the class 19E, the class 50E, and the class 43, the 43 diesel, the GFD, 43 diesels, and the 95 electric. So we are acquiring 28 plus 110 during this year, 422 plus 15, 10 GFP plus 43 locomotives, and 111 diesels and 560 electric. And this is the spending over the next 7 years on the locomotives. This is a manganese line from Hotel to the port of Moha, and what requires to be done here is this line from Hotazel to Kimberley will be upgraded, as well as the line from DR to the port of Moha and Port Elizabeth will be upgraded into double lines. The cost of the rail upgrade will be about 10.6 billion. As I said earlier, the line from Kimberley to DR has already been made double. The project is complete. The cost of work at the port of Moha to build a new manganese terminal is 7.2 billion, and the National Ports Authority will spend about 551.8 million at the port of Moha. This is a current Devon container terminal. It's not quite current. This is the Devon container terminal. This area here does not exist. Part of it is the Salisbury Islands. We will be renting about two-thirds of Salisbury Island from the Public Works and the Defence Force, and we will, because the current port configuration is that it ends here and it goes that way. So we'll be filling in this triangle to create additional stacking capacity. The new tandem lift cranes have been fitted here, and so this is the work that is taking place at Devon Container Terminal. We're spending 6 billion for Pier 2, which is this area here, and another 4 billion for Pier 1, which is this area here. We'll also be spending money, about 3.8 billion, in the preparation of the new dig-out port that we have bought at the old airport. That will be a much longer-term project. A pictorial of the dig-out port. This is a picture of the completed, what the dig-out port will look like after it has been completed, dug out. So that whole area where the water goes in and there is a vessel movement is currently the Devon International Airport. This is Cape Town container terminal. We'll be deepening the berth and the basins to 16 meter chart datum. Key refurbishment, conversion of terminal marshalling yard to staging area, conversion of long jetty and coastal berth areas to RTG operation, Port Industrial Park site across the bridge. And we'll be spending a further 832 million in the port terminals, buying more cranes, 26 dredger carriers, which I believe have been ordered, 32 rubber tired gantry cranes, and 1,850 reefer points to accommodate an increase in refrigeration container capacity. So if you go to the port now, you will see a lot of these reefer points for refrigeration. We are putting in an additional 1,850 for the agricultural sector. Moha, over the next 7 years, will spend about 948 million with buying 4 Megamax ship-to-shore cranes, 18 riot towers. These are just port equipment, basically, 48 haulers, reach trackers, IDP software and equipment. And then we will complete 2 berth container terminals to a total of 4, supported by 60 hectares of backup area. The backup area is this area in yellow. And 4 container berths will be those ones here. This is the port of Richards Bay. We are putting in a new railway line loop to go into the port of Richards Bay. We are buying in 40 plus
where they will triple the trains as they come in. We are getting in a new area for storing of magnetite and other brake valve, and we are having a small coal terminal built here, this cut coal. This is already operating, but on a very small scale, but we are going to increase the capacity of that, especially targeting small coal producers at our own Richards Bay port. This is not the RBC. And the cost of Richards Bay coal terminal development will be developed at South Dunes and 500 series, and we'll spend about $2.9 billion on that. So this is the new multi-product pipeline. I think Shala has spoken about it, but we will be spending a further $6.6 billion on the pipeline. I will ask Raisi Velibule to talk about how the Raisi Velibule is a new group executive for performance, the results management office. We call it the results management office, which measures how we're performing and indicates where the bottlenecks are.
Thank you, Chidi. In terms of the site, really we know the challenge that the MTS poses in terms of executing a $307 billion CAPEX program. So we require, in terms of the human capital, that we have a skilled workforce to execute on that plan, and there are some initiatives in that space relating to the strategic workforce planning. And in the capital investment space, we've put a capital optimization initiative in place, as well as short teams in instances. So short teams, not in that bad sense, but in saying really that where there are challenges with capital execution, that a team of experts that are able to unblock any bottlenecks of the business come in and ensure that those issues are resolved, as well as setting in place a platinum standard for our capital investment. It's really in terms of how we execute capital, the minimum standards that we put in place. So in all this, the results measurement office or execution support office has been put in place to also mitigate some of the risks, market risks, that will arise with the MTS. It's really about being able to diversify our revenues and reduce the dependence that you have around the mining commodities, as well as ensuring that you've got a vigorous marketing program in place to attract new business in areas where Transnet can capture market share, but also ensuring that in our expenditure that we achieve optimal cost in our contracts. So I think really that covers the slight change, and maybe I can just add on the human capital side that the component around skills we have shared in terms of the ramp up for the MTS, the skills improvement and the skills initiatives, the training initiatives in that space that will translate over the 7 years to ensure that we have the proper skills to execute the MTS.
So just to add on the SWAT teams, this is very interesting because special forces, if you like the special forces in the defense force, that will go into capital investment areas just to fix wherever there are problems and blockages. So this will be smaller teams that will just be deployed for particular missions, if you like, in the capital execution program. Chair, the rest of the presentation is about the private sector participation, which is not particularly very interesting. I'll ask Mark to talk about it. Mark, very quickly about PST.
I think we, in our corporate plan, we've got various targets. The first section being the privatization of a few branch lines. And there's a number of big projects that we've spoken about there that are not funded. One of them is the Durban International Airport, the new port itself. So there's a part of the planning function, there's a funding work stream that's looking at models, how it's been done around the world, and we've got a transaction advisor on board to help us come up with a funding for that port. And then there's opportunities within some of the customers our wagons are dedicated to their product. So there's a couple of instances where the customers have actually purchased the wagons and it only runs their goods. It's quite difficult to privatize on the rest of the network where the same rolling stock is used for different commodities. But there are areas where it's dedicated, and those are the easier options for privatization, for private funding. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Thomas, and the team. I wish that our committee could have another opportunity to visit Transnet to look at it before, as you are doing here. I wanted to comment on something that I read in the paper, not what it is. I see there's a serious outcry about your monopolizing is it Transnet Engineering? Yeah, DCP and Union Carriage and Wagon are complaining that it seems you want to deny them access to the 300 billion. But I'm impressed about by this double deck, so that's why I wanted to go and visit Transnet. I'll start that side. Honorable Michael, Honorable Marie, Honorable Mokwena, Kora, and also Honorable Paul.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Malesi, you've put me back in a good mood. I was in a bit of a bad mood earlier. And your presentation.
So now did you agree with
me? Yes. Your presentation today put me back in a good mood. I'm impressed with what I see. I'm impressed, and this is something that's very important. I'm impressed with the transparency at which Transnet comes to this committee. If there's a problem, you tell us what the problem is. We don't have to guess what the problem is. We don't have to read what the problem is in the media. And where there have been problems, Mr. Leffin, this is where I'd like to congratulate you. You have come out and you have explained to the South African public what the problem is, what the cause was, and what your intended solution is. And this is the way a state-owned entity should be run, because South Africans deserve to know what their money is paying for. And in the past 3 months, you have done exactly that. You, not alone, with your team together. And that is impressive and less commendable. I'm exceptionally impressed also with the way yourself, Transnet and Broadband Infraco have gone into partnership with the laying of those cables. You have killed two birds with one stone, and you have saved South Africa money. That is what we're after. That is foresight, that is looking to see what the best for our country is, not who can make the most money and that kind of thing. And that, again, sir, is also commendable. One thing I do want to ask you about, there have been concerns about the dugout hole at Durban. Do you foresee problems coming up in terms of engineering? Because, I mean, it's an absolutely massive undertaking, and also time scales. A lot of people are saying that it's a very good project, but it's a very good project on paper. If we could just have sort of a confirmation, you know, just settle away any fears that we have, that this is perfectly doable and won't relax in sort of problems as we go along, that every possible problem that could occur, we dealt with. Thank you.
Honourable Marie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just go to page 10, in short, with the iron ore line expansion project, as the budget was 772 million, it seems it was like up to that date, in December 2012, it was like an underspend of 190 million. But read the comments on the right-hand side, and in collaboration with that, on page 28, all your comments on the iron ore line. It seems it's a little bit behind with this whole project in total. Is it more on the port side that you're a little bit behind with this project?
Honourable Fenner?
Thank you. Similarly, I'm impressed with this presentation, particularly the farming out of the presentation. Mr. Mudefere, you do not of the presentation, but empowering your members of your team to
And you must be doing something wrong. The D and the A, they agree so much.
Probably not. It's a scooting work. Honorable Michael is absolutely correct. She's on the spot. That's the first part. The second part is just by way of a comment, chairperson, quickly. Now, I'm intrigued and actually fascinated by this contraption, this ultrasonic contraption that you've invented to run ahead of the train in order to detect possible danger, threats of it. I'm just trying to conjecture it in my mind, conceive of it in my mind. Is it something like a toy gadget? What is it? But what is this that's now? I would suggest that it should also be adopted by PRASA in order to mitigate the collision of trains. Not only the dimension of the runway that could refer to the train, but we've had many cases where one train is stationary, the other one is just coming and just goes in the way. Well, if they got such a gadget there, then it will obviate a lot of curses. But then I also wanted to ask, linked to that person, do you fit CCTV cameras on the wagons, on the trains, so that even if there's no derailment, but the train is up there, and you can actually see and record if there's any theft, people looting, etc., so that they can be traced. Because in some cases, most of the trains stop in the middle of nowhere, and the people just come up there and help themselves and so on, and without any trace or detection for investigation by the police. That's number one. Number two, your branch lines. Transnet's got a length of 21,000 kilometers of rail, 8,000 of which are branch lines that go into ghost towns like Loughborough, Phillipstown, etc. Now I hear that your strategy is to make them viable by privatizing them. Now I just wonder, to what extent does this fit with the developmental agenda of the government? Because you see, the previous regime, widespread, we set up all these branch lines because to create work and to bring life to those outlying areas, in the rural areas, etc. Now, because they're not economically viable, Transnet, that has plummeted, pull back business, and then those towns are just lying there, derelict, so to speak. Now, if you privatize it, I just wonder to what extent that clash with the developmental agenda of the government, because you know what privatization means. It means just making money at any cost, cover the cost, etc. And what does it do to those people who are staying in those areas there because there's unemployment, etc. And finally, the Emerald Harbor, I heard you say that you have a strategy that the train must not stop there. It must just carry on in order to reach Richards Bay very quickly and then optimize the tonnage of Richards Bay, etc. That's excellent from the efficiency point of view. But to what extent will this harm the town of Emerald? Because I should imagine that the town is benefiting revenue if more trains park, etc., employment, etc. I know it's not a very easy answer, but I'm just saying we strike a balance between realizing efficiency and killing unintentionally some of the time the economies of certain towns.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Mr. Mabrif and his team. Transnet has always been the jewel of the state-owned companies when they appear before us in this committee. And I think you did justice again today, you and your team, to really focus and adhering to your developmental mandate, but also investing in the economy and rolling out this investment plan. And we wish you well on that. You're really one of the best-run state-owned companies in South Africa at the moment, from a human resources perspective, but also business plan and developmental mandate. So we really need to congratulate Transnet on that. Very brief questions. The underspend in the Transnet pipelines, cumulative to December 2012, is quite substantial, from 3 billion to 1.6. I just need a clarity. Why is it underspend or cumulative to December 2012? So, and On the same issue, what was the initial cost? I can't find it in your documentation. In 2008, the initial cost of the pipeline from Durban to Jameson Park, and what is now the estimated cost? I just need clarity, and then linked to that, did you expect any delay? Did you experience any delays just recently on construction of the pipeline? Bad weather or whatever the case may be, and what are the details? That's the first one. Secondly, you've said today to us, and all your ports, especially your Durban port entrance widening, your Saldanha, the iron ore deepening of the port properly, the filling of Salisbury Island, the Durban Deckard port, those are huge potential impacts on the environment. What have you done as Transnet to ensure our nation and the next generations to come that our environment will be protected and there will not be unintended consequences due to your investment in doing your rollout program? Especially in Saldanha, where you are going up from 60 million ton to 82 million ton, two additional tippers. I mean, if you go into Saldanha, you will find a lot of red dust by the tippers probably going in. And how do you manage that? It's an environmental impact. Do you work closely with other government departments? Who takes final responsibility for pollution of the air or pollution of the area in your ports? Probably same. We went to Richards Bay with a coal, same there. That's my second question. What do you do with your environmental management? And then lastly, your private sector. This Durban Deckard port is probably your prime example where you need private sector to come in and funding. What does Transnet do to ask private sector to come up with a funding? Because I get the impression, rightly or wrongly, they're not willing to invest. So what do we do to attract them? And do we have to do, as a state-owned company, anything more to get private sector interested, for instance, in the Durban Deckard port? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. One of my questions also, obviously I come from Durban, so the Deckard port is also of concern to me, but the questions have been asked. Let me just add onto that. What part are you playing, because obviously this is a partnership, it's not Transnet on its own, in the community participation that is happening at the moment. And you know, we do place quite a big emphasis on the community participation. If you could just give us some idea. And I think also, as the Honourable Kurnop has mentioned, the geotechs, the environmental assessments, you know, those are going to be critical. I think I want to, I know we're dealing with infrastructure here, but I just want to also comment about the little tree that runs ahead of the, you know, to find the fault. I think it's not that long ago in this committee that we actually raised this thing, because we didn't have anything like that. I think it's quite a recent thing. So it's very good to know that some of the discussions we have here actually do find their way into being implemented somewhere along the line. And then just the last thing I would like to know, we've also had much discussion about the road to rail. What success are you having now? Because I know some while ago in your planning and everything, it was a case of having to prove yourselves that you were sufficiently efficient to move stuff for people. They've got to, you know, have their trust in you. What sort of progress are you making in that regard?
Thank you for the congratulatory words from everybody that is in the committee. Um,
I don't know if you know, Chair, that you say we can bring the ANC and the DA together, but but in 1910, with the Union of South Africa, Cape Town became the head of the legislature, Bloemfontein, the judiciary, Pretoria, executive, and Durban, as part of the agreement, was South African Railway and Harbours. So the President, the Speaker of Parliament, the Chief Justice, and the CEO of Transnet, from a protocol point of view. But on the bigger part, engineering and time scales, we have not started the site engineering studies of how we're going to do the digger port. At the moment, it's very, very broad. We are at FEL1, which is the initial environmental impact study. So the things at the moment that are happening on the site is that we are assessing what the environmental impact of the digger port is going to be. There are certain problems. For example, that area was an airport, so there is a jet fuel that has on the spilled onto the ground, which we are now digging out to find out how far it goes into the ground so that we can decide what we will do from an environmental point of view with the soil that is dug out. Because part of it will go into the sea, but the question is how deep must you go before you can take it out into the sea. So we are assessing the contaminated areas. There are people who are looking at the species of animals that are there at the moment. We know that there are 11 black mambas. There is somebody who follows them all the time. I don't know how AXA and SAA survived without the black mamba getting into somebody's suitcase. But now we discover there are 11 black mambas that are quite happy to stay on that side. There are some rare frogs and a chameleon. So we are negotiating about the relocation, possible relocation and so on. Just to add that there is nothing that we'll do from an environmental point of view without the approval of the Department of Environmental Affairs. So we have to get environmental approvals. So at the moment we are at a stage where we are just assessing what is on the ground from an environmental impact point of view. The second phase will be, and the third phase will be, going into the engineering, how the digging will happen, where the beds will be constructed. That picture there just shows just an artist's impression. It is not in any engineering, does not have any engineering significance at all, but the possible artist's impression. In fact, there are about three or four variations to how we can actually structure the port, and this will be informed by the draft, the way the water will come into the port, the way the pedals will turn around, and so on. So the detailed engineering will come at FEL3, so we are still at FEL1, and then we will know more details about the engineering, and in fact, even a proper cost estimate. The annual line expansion spending is behind. The thing with capital expenditure is that it is not linear. It is it spikes. So sometimes it can look like we are behind schedule, but maybe there is an administration somewhere of one big payment that needs to be done in a few months' time. And so by December it looks like we're behind schedule, but in February we just make one big payment. So I would not worry about sort of linear projections of CAPEX. Because CAPEX is the way that we spend, it comes with spikes. It's not linear. It just doesn't follow any pattern. It is a function of how quickly the invoices are processed, how quickly the invoices are submitted, how quickly the work is done, and so on and so forth. And then you see spikes right towards the end of the year and so on. So I wouldn't worry about total expenditure at the end of December, which is still 3 months to go in the year. But having said that, there has also been savings. There are projects that we have undertaken at a particular budget level, but that are coming in under budget. And generally, if you saw, a lot of the projects look like we are underspending. I've always said, you know, it's better to come back to say we've underspent than we've overspent. Because I grew up in the National Treasury where overspending is just not allowed. So there is that discipline at Transnet as well. So it's better to hold back your horses if you're not sure about spending rather than run and just finish all the money quickly. So it's better in the bank than having been spent quickly. That as well. So we're not concerned about the quality of the product that is being delivered or the quality of the spending. The underspending does not reflect a poor ability of spending. It just reflects administration and even possible savings in certain instances. And in certain instances, just perhaps the work being behind as well. But it is a better problem to have than if I was sitting here answering why we are overspending. I'm sure that it would be more. The ultrasonic train, Mr. Chairman, is actually part, just one small part of a very big project that is happening at Transnet. We have budgeted 1 billion rand for research and development. And this has been one of the projects. The other project in the research and development by engineer, I think this runaway is how much of it is in the R&D. but part of it is the 1 billion rand. We are recruiting young engineers who are coming out of the university, the best engineers, the best students, attracting them to Transnet to come and join our engineering and R&D. And some of the things that they're working on, Chair, are exciting. Like, whenever a train comes to a standstill, it breaks. Whenever it breaks, it generates electricity, a lot of electricity. So you can imagine a train full of coal that comes to a standstill, that is coming to a standstill as I speak to you now. The amount of electricity that is being generated and then lost because we can't capture it is more than a power station. So we have started a project in R&D to measure how much electricity we generate and to find out ways of capturing that electricity. And in due course, I think we will find something. And this is something that we're doing in South Africa. We have already so far progressed in measuring how much electricity we generate. Now we need to enter into negotiations with Eskom of how we put it back into the grid, or if we can find, there is no battery that can keep that electricity. It's too much, way too much. Or we can transfer it to the next town. Or so the next problem is, so now that we know how much electricity we generate, what do we do with it and how do we help the national electrification effort? And if we can, I argue that it is probably another power station, just from the trains, all of the trains. And we set the standard that every time a train breaks, the electricity is generated to capture it. Even at the ports, when a train lifts up a container, it uses electricity. But when it drops the container, so because it uses gravity, that generates electricity. And that electricity can put back into the train by way of a battery. And the calculations are we can save up to 25% electricity on the operation. So this R&D thing is actually quite exciting. The level crossings, we had people dying in Mpumalanga last year, about 30 people at the level crossing. Now we are investigating through research and development a way of making it impossible to approach a railway line when a train is approaching. So when a train is within a certain distance, something must happen at the crossing so that you can't go around it, you can't go above it, you can't go under it. You will not be able to cross there. Without damaging your car and allowing the train to pass without touching your car. So, I mean, we said that is the problem. The engineering people must come up with a solution that is cost-effective that we can implement as soon as possible. But one of the things that we're thinking about also is to approach Parliament to pass a law that will make it compulsory for local authorities to enforce local traffic laws at level crossings. Because when an accident happens, all the level crossings have got a stop sign. It's usually because somebody did not stop. And that is a local traffic law that is not being enforced. So we need somehow to enforce even the laws that are existing by the local authorities. But we are looking at an engineering solution that will stop this thing completely so you cannot cross a level crossing. So the ultrasonic train is also one of the things that, that we have been doing the engineering, and now I have commissioned on the line sort of new technology that we're talking about. Branch lines concessioning and privatization, I think we'll announce more branch lines concessions. There are three branch lines that are ready to be concessioned. But the Honorable Mugwena's concern is that why are we selling off these? If you look at this map, it actually shows you a summary of the core railway network of South Africa. So it's Musina to Johannesburg, Johannesburg to Cape Town, Sishen to Saldanha, Sishen to Port Elizabeth, and then Sishen to Noha, and then Johannesburg to East London, Johannesburg to Noha, Durban, Johannesburg, and Richards Bay. This is the core network. And then from this, there are smaller 60 lines that are all over the place, that are smaller.
So even when we talk about branchline concession, we are not talking about the concessioning of this core network. So this core network will remain in Transnet, and this is the core network that we will use to transport major commodities. So this is the main network. But from between Musina and Polokwane, there are smaller lines that go there. And in fact, I think we're building another core line from the Palale, to Emelo that we saw in the slide. So that will be, there will be another line here that I think also be called for coal from the Palale. So it is not, we are not talking at all about the concessioning of the core network, but in between, because for example here in Moha, now East London, they've just found coal here, and there is a small branch line that runs from somewhere inland into East London. We are quite happy to concession because it is not part of the core network, and the amounts of coal there are not very big. The Emelo hub will not be destroyed, because if we divert GFB to Swaziland, there will be more coal trades from the waterbed, because we are opening up the waterbed now, and the trains from Botswana that will come with more coal through Emelo. So what will happen is that if we don't do that, Emelo will become congested. Emelo is already congested. So it will become even more congested if we start pushing trains from Tarazimbi and Botswana for the waterbed through Emelo. So what we're doing is that it's an outlet really through Swaziland. And if you look at the map, this is the link. So the trains, Emelo is somewhere here. Also Emelo is there. So the trains will be directed to Lotse and through to Swaziland, and they will only be in Swaziland up to there. And they will be in transit. And then from there they will rejoin a network in South Africa to Richards Bay. So it's just a diversion here. This will also be in time upgraded to heavy haul, 26 axle load. And in time, not now, maybe in 20 years time, because this will be built as a heavy haul, and then the rest must be upgraded to heavy haul. And we can, if we want, also put through coal trains through Swaziland, but much later on if there is a lot of traffic. The underspend, I think I have... Honorable Koranoff was talking about underspend. I can't remember which project it was. Oh, the pipeline. Yeah, the original cost was about 12 billion. It is now standing at about 23 billion. But we must remember that the original size of the line was supposed to be 16-inch, and we've now built a 24-inch pipeline. And
the original amount didn't include the two terminals, which have the accumulation facilities that will have 3 days worth of stock. Because we've got two jet tanks, two diesel tanks, and two petrol tanks in both inland and coastal terminals.
The environmental impact of the Digor port, I've already spoken about it. Mark, I don't know if you want to talk about it.
I think just the point on the...
As well as the PSP for the Digor port.
Okay, the Digor port. Although there's an artist's impression of what is done there, the actual concept was studied by professional port designers, and after investigating a number of options and a number of sites. And before we went ahead and purchased the extra land, we did an exercise called the fatal flaws analysis, where we tried to identify every possibility that could be a fatal flaw for the project, and we didn't find any fatal flaws, so we went ahead and purchased the extra site. The FEL1 phase, which we're currently in, is the optioneering phase, where we look at all the different design options. We are currently doing geotech drilling on the airport site, on the beach where the entrance channel would be. We've got detailed drawings of the seabed. We've got detailed information from EXA. So it's at this stage where we will end up with three or four probable options, then take that through to the second phase where we'll do more engineering work and select one of those options. It'll go into the third phase, which is detailed engineering of the solution, and then finally execution. We only start or plan to start construction in 2016, if it is. So this next 2 years is all about planning, design, engineering. And there's nothing that we've found yet that's going to that showstopper. If I can use the soil that has to be dug out as an example, I think it's 70 million cubic meters. If it's all fine, we would seek to get an offshore dump permit. We'd use some of it on site, and the rest will be dumped offshore. If it's contaminated, there's certain ways, certain levels of contamination where you can treat the soil and then dump it off site. And if there's certain sections that are can't be treated that have to be dumped at a hazardous dump site, you know, that will be the solution. So what I'm saying is it's not anything that's going to stop it going ahead, it's more the solution and the cost of that solution. And that we'll only find out as we go along. In terms of the funding, the area where we might find difficulty in securing private funding is for the actual port infrastructure, the breakwater, the entrance channel, you know, the item that's going to be a 100-year asset. There's no shortage of private sector interest in actually funding the terminals within the port. So we're looking at those options, and we've got experienced people assisting us with that. I think there was also a question on the community engagement.
Yes, yes.
I think we've had, with Brian, we've been to a number of communities over the weekend. The last one was the Wentworth, Women of Wentworth community. So there's extensive community engagement going on. Perhaps just one point on the iron ore line as well. Although it said that there's we're a little bit behind, that was on the expansion to 60 million tonne. It only the delivery of locomotives, but for last year it didn't stop our ability to deliver all the iron ore that was available to deliver. And the reference to page 28 is the expansion from 60 to 82, which is the next expansion.
Chair, on the community participation, I mean, for me, the most instructive comment from the community was that they were saying, you're going to do this project, there's going to be jobs that are created, but now we know that you're going to tell us that we don't have the skills. So they are saying, can you please train us ahead of starting project, so that when project starts, we have the skills. And I think that was a very constructive comment, that we're now going to follow up and design training programs for employment during the construction as well as post-construction, so that jobs can be created. But then one of the things that we agreed with the community is that they must prepare their children that are now in crèche to start having certain skills that will be required at the port and even at sea, like swimming and so on, with a view of them playing a certain part in the port in the future, because it will actually be finished in 2040 when their children are of working age, and a lot of them and us are long in retirement. And so that is one of the things that was said at the community participation. Just the increase in volumes on both rail, if we can start.
Yes, we're making good progress on this. If you look at the road rates, we begin to experience in containers, you know, cars, some of these commodities, which are ahead of the economic growth rate, and also looking at technologies, you know, for the road trailer, you know, where you can lift the trailer of a truck and put it on a train and transport it. So that as well, we've gone out on the market on, and it's better accelerate the road to rail initiative.
No, I think that if people say that you know, you are going to cut them out of your own money, but we are continuing to find a role to play for the private sector in South Africa. The big opportunity that exists is that when we buy the locomotives, because the DCDW and UCW are in fact manufacturers, we are going to assemble these trains at Transnet, and we're spending a lot of money on research and development and a lot of things. But we are not going to be able to produce the components, and we would like the components to be produced in South Africa. So the South African engineering industry, including the civil government, should prepare itself. They must identify certain components that will become their niche that we can procure,
because what we are planning to do is really to assemble the trains at engineering. But and the reason we are doing the assembling of the trains at engineering is because as we assemble the trains, we would also like to do a lot of research and development in methods of assembly, but also with the view, possibly one day, of building our own train. So it is very much part of the R&D project, yeah, that we are putting them together. But the parts, I mean, the windscreen, the wipers, the seats, the parts of the engine, parts of the traction motor, parts of this and that, the radiator, the cooling system, we are going to buy from the private sector. And so I think companies must, in the engineering, we are not excluding anyone, we are going to procure. Well, there's no way that we're going to manufacture all the parts of the train or of a locomotive or of a wagon at the Transnet engineering. So we are not excluding them.
As long as Transnet takes us to industrialization of our country, we are happy with what you are doing. I think this brings us to the end of our meeting. I'd like to thank again Mr. Mulefe and his team, and also to wish you well in continuing with your good work. I wish all of you good health and long life, and I thank honorable members for their invaluable input in this meeting. We now have our last item, and that is the consideration and adoption of the minutes. Transnet is free to go, if you so wish, but hang around if you want to. Sorry, I haven't, I want to thank the department for being here. Although I didn't give you an opportunity, I know you wanted to say something, but you'll pardon me. I always confuse my with someone who's representing the department, and I still get that out of my head. Thank you.